I know it was a 5-round fight. I just tried to pay myself, but that was some bull.
What a fight. Cub Swanson, first of all, congratulations on winning one of the best fights I've ever seen in my life. You want to fight again in a couple of weeks?
Yeah, Denver, Colorado, baby, 1,000%.
Talk to Dana, shaking his head. Look at him over there.
I don't know if Pettis can make that weight. Pettis has made 46 before, but he's never actually made 45 that I know of.
Hashtag, where's Jose Waldo? Let me know when you guys find him. I'll be waiting at Dana White. That's 50 G's right there. This man never been stopped before.
Watching Alistair Overeem kickbox.
No, Westworld.
Let's not bring that up, all right? We don't need to bring up the sadness of my life.
No, that's completely normal to watch one series 4 times in 2 weeks.
Well, some people just appreciate art.
Some people do. Are you one of those people?
No.
No.
No, I'm a pathetic jackass. And down goes Overeem, so. I'm actually sad because I can't watch last night's pay-per-view or UFC 206, whenever this is airing. Because it's on my computer, and I don't trust my computer to do more than one thing at a time. So recording a podcast is all I trust it to do.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Probably, clearly the most important thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have watched the main card of the pop pay-per-view about 5 times today, so I can take a break.
I don't usually rewatch stuff like that. I mean, there's some fights I'll rewatch just because I want to see if guys have changed or improved or whatever, but it's rare like I would ever sit back and go through an entire card again the next day.
Yeah, well, I'm not normal. I'm rare.
No, neither am I.
Let's just say that I'm rare. That's a good way to call me. I'm rare. I'm
yes.
A special flower in the midst of the weeds.
Yeah, I agree. That seems like an apt description for you.
It is. And so absolutely. Everybody listening, you're obviously listening to Who the Fuck Are These Fook? Who the fuck are those guys? Although I'm thinking about coming up with a better name for iTunes, at least when it's displayed. So it'll be like fighting and words. Something more basic so people go, oh, I wonder what that's all about. I don't know. Nobody cares. It's a show. It's halfguarded.com. We're in the middle of it. Matt already did the opening. I haven't actually listened to the opening yet, but every time I do, I always smile because I'm like, that's a great quote. That's a great clip. And I expect this week to be no different.
Yeah, this is my favorite one yet. I should say you will eventually probably get sued for it, but that's okay. You're a lawyer. It'll be fine.
Bring it on, motherfuckers. It's fair use in my world. This is a news program. It's not fair use. Actually, we're probably more likely to get in trouble for the underlying music than the clips of people saying things, but whatever.
That's true. Anyway, some of those are weird, like instrumentals that aren't really the song. They're like up on YouTube anyway. So I actually think they might be okay because it's a knockoff of the song, but it's real close.
Man, it doesn't matter. Just say take it down and I'll be like, okay, I'll take it down. I'm sorry. And then that'll get more publicity. We'll be the people that ripped off Jay-Z and he sued us. So. Let's go, Hova. Let's go, motherfucker. It took me forever to realize when he called himself Jehovah. I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? I'm like, oh, it's Jehovah. He's calling himself God. I had no idea. So clearly, Raft was a little beyond my minimal capabilities. But yes, we'll stop the part where I ramble and turn it over to Matt to do this. And hopefully, our audio quality is. This will be the best audio quality I think we will ever have. I'm doing the dual recording on my end, and Matt's got his special microphone. So let's make the magic happen.
Yeah, let's see how this sounds. So this past weekend there were 3 shows. Depends on your viewpoint. Most people would probably consider minor shows, even though one was a pay per view, UFC 206. But on Friday night, we had Bellator, which is from Italy. In the main event of that show, Alessio Sicara beat Joey Beltran by TKO in the first round. It was over quick. Otherwise, not a lot of names on that show. Not a whole lot to talk about there.
Didn't Melvin Manoff fight?
He was supposed to, but I think either him or Carvalho got injured or something.
Oh, shit. When I saw that it was recording on my DVR, I'm like, oh, Manoff is going to fight. Now I know. Well, I don't really care if I watch it.
Do you remember their first fight?
I presume it's like every Melvin fight where he kind of looks good and then he gets clipped.
No, it went five rounds. It was awful. Like, worst fight of all time. Like, I was surprised they did the rematch. He fought for their middleweight title probably 4 months ago, and it was so bad you don't even remember it.
Is Carvalho their middleweight champion?
Yeah, last I knew.
I know Shlemenko was champion, but he lost it when he popped or something. So, whatever, it doesn't matter. Bellator's got... Actually, they're doing better as far as having guys who are champions. I'm like, oh, okay, that's kind of legitimate. But granted, given that their last heavyweight champion, the man is still technically holding the belt, just fought on UFC Fight Pass. So, Bellator champions, not exactly high up in my MMA memory bank here.
No. Then also on Friday night, we had one of probably the least watched fight nights in UFC history. It was from Albany, New York, at the Times Union Center. Attendance was 6,200 with a total gate of $411,000. In the main event, Derek Lewis beat Shamil Abdurakhimov by TKO at 3:42 in the fourth round. Basically, at the end of the fight, Lewis just got on top of Abdurakhimov and pounded him out, essentially. Kind of a lackluster fight until then. In the first few rounds, Abdurakhimov got a few takedowns. But post-fight was probably the highlight, where Derek Lewis said it was his terriblest fight ever. Any thoughts on that main event?
No, the main event was garbage. It was actually a decent show. A couple of the guys in the undercard, I thought, put on performances where I'm like, okay, that's not bad. That kind of surprised me a little bit. But the main event, I mean, it's one of those fights where everybody's a loser. The Black Beast, yeah, he got the win, but he really just got the win because he got taken down so many times his opponent got tired. And he didn't show anything. And frankly, against a good wrestler, he probably, that's weird because the heavyweight division used to be filled with top, big wrestlers, and now it's kind of evolved. So, whatever. It's heavyweights. You can have a shitty performance and still go out and knock out the world champion in the first minute of the next fight. It's such a weird sport.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that became apparent to me was that Lewis is a strong dude. Even at heavyweight, he can throw people around and drop bombs on guys. But the skill level just isn't there. There's not a lot of technique. He's kind of just a brawler. But looking at the heavyweight division, he's 31, which is young for a heavyweight in the UFC right now. So a couple wins. I mean, he needs a name win, like somebody, like Overeem or Arlovsky or Barnett, somebody like that to kind of get to the next level. So we'll see where he goes from here, but a win's a win, I guess.
And he did call out Arlovsky, to his credit. That's kind of one of the names he half mumbled as he called himself a shit fighter and stuff like that. And it's probably, it's not a bad fight. It's kind of, it would really give an idea of where both guys stand. So I don't mind it. Go for it, UFC. Do it.
Then in the semi-main event, Francis Ngannou defeated Anthony Hamilton via Kimura at 157 of the first round.
This was impressive.
Okay,
tell us. This is something when Francis Ngannou is from France. So, it's kind of weird to name your kid Francis if you're from France. But I don't know. There's no kid named England. But, Ngannou's, I'm pretty sure he's under 30.
Do you know where Ngannou was born?
I'm going to guess Cameroon.
Wow. I feel like you knew that. That's a very random guess.
No, I'm only guessing because I'm pretty sure it's a French, former French colony, and a lot of, if you see a black guy who speaks French, they tend to be Cameroonian.
Okay.
So, I would guess Cameroon, and then his family immigrated. I don't know which one's correct. It's a, France proper. But, is that true? Did you see that? Is that right?
No, he's from Cameroon. Yeah.
Oh, fuck, I fucking nailed it.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Nice. Well, that's pat me on the back there. He's kind of new to the sport. They're talking about he's only been training like 4 years. But the finish he pulled off, it was a rolling Kimura. It's a technique that's it's been done a couple of times, but most famously when Sakuraba fought Henzo Gracie, broke Henzo's arm in the process. You know, when the guy is standing up behind you, it's a decent defense, but usually guys don't actually get the submission with it. It just keeps your opponent honest so that you can't really, you know, do a big throw and it slows him down. So you do a double wrist lock and threaten the Kimura, but he actually rolled through with it and got the tap. And, big guys don't do things like that for the most part. Even, you know, guys like Frank Mir tend not to have done things like that. He's still, you know, new and young, but he seems athletic, not just because of his, melatonin, yeah. But yeah, you know, that, to me, he was the most, one of the two or three most impressive fighters of the night.
About, why not do Lewis versus Ngannou next?
You know, you could do that. I think if I'm Lewis, I would say that's a step down, just name-wise.
Sure.
It's, you know, Ngannou, this is probably the first time anybody's ever really seen him fight. He's still young. He's got a ways to go.
He is 30.
Well, heavyweight young.
Right.
Fight game young. I mean, that's the thing with heavyweights, is that it only takes 3 or 4 wins and you're in the top 10, and you don't get a lot of time to develop. And I still see him as a developing fighter. But, so yeah, I'd rather him probably fight somebody else a little closer to his skill. I think Derek Lewis is a little too experienced for him. And I think Lewis is ready for a real name guy, whether it's a top 10 guy or not, but whether it's Arlovsky or maybe Josh Barnett, you can find any of the kind of older heavyweights, a little redundant, but somebody like that.
Right. Then closing out the main card on Fight Pass, we had Corey Anderson defeating Sean O'Connell by TKO at 236 in the second, and then Jean Vellante beat Saperbek Safarov by TKO at 254 in the second. So, anything to note there? Either guy impressed you?
They were entertaining fights. Jean Vellante gassed more than he should have. I thought Corey Anderson looked very good. Sean O'Connell should not be fighting a light heavyweight. He really should be fighting at least at middleweight. But Corey Anderson just ragdolled him as far as takedowns are concerned. And brutally grounded and pounded him. Jean Vellante, again, he did what he's supposed to do, which is win, but it's not like I walked away going, oh, God, I can't wait to see him fight again. And at light heavyweight, there's enough guys who are really, really good at light heavyweight, whereas, like, if Vellante was a heavyweight with that kind of performance, I'd be like, well, he's still a heavyweight, he's still got power, he can knock anybody out. But at 205, there's so many guys that are really world-class technique-wise that what he displayed is just, it's not going to cut it.
And, I mean, the one thing between all those two fights was, like, the beating Safarov took. Like, he was getting pounded on. His face was hammered. I think he came in short notice. It was his first fight in the UFC. But he took a beating and kind of kept coming until the ref stopped it. On the undercard, anybody catch your eye? I mean, there were only two finishes on the undercard. Randy Brown won by TKO. Gerald Meerschaert won with an anaconda. But other than that, it was all decisions, unanimous decisions across the board.
Yeah, Justine Kish got the decision over Ashley Yoder. I thought it was a bad decision. I thought Yoder should have had it. Yoder, I really was just rooting for because she was very, very, very cute. Randy Brown destroyed Brian Camozzi, Chris Camozzi's brother. No one gives a crap. Gerald Meerschaert, GM3, as he calls himself. He's a Rufus Fort guy, real nice guy. I met him a couple times. I don't think he remembers me, because why would he? But he's one of these guys that's been on the independent circuit forever. And it kind of shows a difference between heavyweight and other divisions, because he's 30, but he's at middleweight, and everybody looks at him as like this grizzled old veteran who finally got his shot. Meanwhile, we're talking about 30-year-old heavyweights as being young, up-and-coming prospects.
Right.
To me, the maybe the most impressive guy of the night was Shane Burgos, who took on Thiago Traitor. It was Burgos' debut. I think he was on semi-short notice. And he absolutely annihilated Traitor. Not that Traitor is some world beater or anything like that, but this was the kind of fight where, you know, you would expect to see when one guy is at a significantly higher level skill wise than another guy, and to do it on short notice and at featherweight where everybody's kind of skilled, I thought Burgos, I thought he stood out as much as anybody on the card. Nobody else, everything else sucked. It sucked that it was just there and no one will ever remember it. I couldn't.
No, absolutely.
Like, this is.
It's like shows from Croatia. Nobody's going to remember them.
I remember when Krokop pounded out Gonzaga. I think that was Krokop.
Okay.
Part of the reason I remember that is one is Krokop, too. I was in a hotel room at my cousin's wedding. My brother and I were watching it, and we had just watched it finish. They're like, okay, we got to go to the wedding now. As we're tying our ties as we're watching Krokop ground pound them. But other than that, yeah. It's a show from Albany. I wrote in the intro, you know, this is like payback for having the most amazing card ever at UFC 205. Now they get Albany as like a return, which is kind of like, you know, having sex with a beautiful woman and 3 weeks later finding out you have herpes. This show was herpes.
Yeah, I mean, well, we kind of talked about that, loading up like these giant supercards. Something's got to give. In the last couple weekends, I mean, it kind of is what it is. When you load up a card with 10 great fights with named fighters, you're going to have trouble the next several weeks because all those guys are going to be out of commission for a while.
I can't remember if we talked about what the main event of the show was supposed to be, if somebody dropped out, but, I mean, it was on Fight Pass, which means you shouldn't expect anything of it, but why didn't anybody think that this would be a show to run? Like, that's your main event? Like, at least with Australia and stuff like that, I'm like, okay, they had a really high-quality fight. Same with UFC 206. Something dropped out. They tried to make do, whatever. But as far as I remember, this show has always just been garbage.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this was always the main event. I mean, I can double-check. Because I remember Derek Lewis, although he didn't have the most exciting fight, is pretty fun on Twitter. And he was asked, he was claiming like he didn't know who the guy he was fighting was and never heard of him. And I kind of believe him. I wouldn't be surprised if he had never heard of Abdurakhimov. But from what I can tell, that was always the main event.
Maybe it's just part of the UFC, using classical conditioning of their fans to get them used to guys with unpronounceable Eastern European names headlining shows, because it's going to happen more and more in the future.
There was talk of Aljamain Sterling versus Rafael Assuncao at one point, but Sterling pulled out because he was hurt.
But even that would have been a main event.
I know, it would have been the semi-main probably, but it would have been something. So following that card, probably the most unheralded UFC fight night ever, we followed up with one of the probably least drying pay-per-view events in recent UFC history. We had UFC 206 from the Air Canada Center in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Attendance was 18,057 with a $1.8 million gate. So a very good drawing show as far as attendance and gate goes, but on pay-per-view, this thing's going to die a slow death. Obviously, the original main event was Daniel Cormier versus Anthony Johnson. Cormier had to pull out to injury, something with an adductor, I think, or a groin tear or something.
I think
like
it was
that.
His groin, yeah.
Yeah.
Always
yeah.
A groin.
Does not sound pleasant. So this show ended up having the much ballyhooed main event of Max Holloway versus Anthony Pettis, with the idea this was for the interim featherweight title. The day of the weigh-ins, though, Pettis could not make weight and weighed in at 148 pounds. So the deal was Holloway was still eligible to win this interim featherweight title, which really shouldn't have been happening anyway. And Pettis couldn't because he didn't make weight. In the end, Holloway ended up pulling out the win by TKO with punches at 450 in the third round. A good fight. Early on, Pettis appeared to injure his hand. He said it was broken after the fight. I don't know if that's been confirmed or not, but his hand was swollen. It was his right hand. So that probably hampered Pettis quite a bit. I'm guessing the weight cut didn't help his cause any either. But even so, Holloway slowly started picking away and gaining steam as the fight went on. and ended up winning the interim title in the third round by TKO.
Yeah, congratulations to Max Holloway. Setting aside the ridiculousness of him winning a fake title so that he can challenge for a real title that was a fake title that just became a real title and all that horse shit. You know, Max Holloway is somebody that will not get accolades as Fighter of the Year, but when you look at it, he destroyed Ricardo Lamas, and a couple months later, then Anthony Pettis. Like, he's on a run that very few people have ever put together. It's been a little bit under the radar. He is clearly the number one contender for Jose Aldo. He had a cute little line calling him Jose Waldo, which is, whatever, he's doing whatever he can. But, you know,
Where's Aldo? I like that.
Yeah.
The thing with him is he's trying. Like, yeah. you got to respect that. Like, he doesn't have the natural, like, innate charisma that, you know, your Conor or McGregor's or Chael's or whoever do. But I feel like he's kind of turned a corner and gets it a little bit more than maybe he did 2 or 3 years ago when nobody knew who he was, or going into the first Aldo fight.
Exactly, yeah. And as long as you're trying that more than most people do with his style, which is entertaining, and he's got just being Hawaiian adds a little extra to you, I think, because it's kind of like you get all the benefits of American nationalism, but you're still kind of foreignish. But, you know, it's like you're a little different, so I think it helps guys stand out. And plus, again, he went out there and he fought Anthony Pettis, and whether Pettis broke his hand or not, which clearly it was hurt. He was not throwing that right hand in the later rounds. You know, to finish Pettis the way he did, and it was clinical. I thought Pettis would have had the edge with, you know, the sharpness of kicks, especially to the body. The way Holloway was snapping those things off, like, that's going to hurt anybody. I don't know if he can do it with Jose Aldo. Aldo is almost a different level of fighter than anybody when he's on. But if you ever wanted to build a guy up to make him look like a world champion, fucking Max Holloway's right there. When you're only, I guess he lost earlier in his career, but, you know, his only real loss people remember was to Conor McGregor. And since then, he's just been on this insane tear, and the opponents have gradually gotten more and more difficult and higher profile. And every single time Holloway has stepped up to the plate, he's held his own. He has not cracked under pressure. You know, there's a lot of weird shit going on with this fight. The fact that Pettis didn't make weight was an embarrassment, and it just kind of further encapsulated just the sadness of this show, which is too bad, because when it was over, it was, I mean, one of the greatest pay-per-views of all time, just because of at least one fight, if not two or three of them. But, you know, I jokingly was calling it UFC 206 Steal This Show, because I referenced pop culture that way. I don't know, wrote the book, Steal This, I can't remember who did it, but whatever. But yeah, all credit to Max Holloway. Good for you, buddy.
So two questions. Obviously, Holloway is coming off 10 straight wins. Should fight Aldo next for the, you put him in quotation marks, the real featherweight championship of the world. How do you like his chances against Aldo? And what do you think Pettis does from here? He's saying he can't make 145, but his recent run at 155 wasn't so hot either. At 29, kind of at a crossroads for him. Where do you see Pettis going?
I'll start with Pettis because it's fresher in my mind. I hope he's saving his money and he got insurance on those cars that broke down. Or got burned, I should say.
Do you think he's shot? Like he's only 29. And granted, he's been fighting the best guys in the world. But I feel like he's so far away from the dude who tapped out Benson Henderson and choked out Gilbert Melendez and destroyed Donald Cerrone. Like, I watched that Cerrone fight again. He murdered Cerrone. And now Cerrone's just mowing through 170-pound guys. It's bizarre to me.
He's always been a fighter, and I've said this for years, Anthony Pettis was a Lamborghini. And Lamborghinis are something that everybody looks at and they think, oh, it's amazing, and such an impressive performing machine, but it requires a lot of maintenance, and if one little, they break down all the time. You know, you have to almost, I remember you once, if you own a Lamborghini, if you want to drive it regularly, you essentially need to hire a full-time mechanic just to keep it up, as opposed to, you know, a Ford Taurus where you take it in once every 5 years for your oil change and it still runs. 29, he's really not, like, physically beaten down so much as I don't think that his body was ever going to be long for the sport to begin with. He's such a, again, a fine-tuned athlete. I think he's now a camp-to-camp fighter, meaning that when he's not training for a fight, he's not really working really, really hard in the gym. You'll see that, you know, some guys become that later in their life. And not that he's lazy, but he should be able to make 145 just frame-wise. He shouldn't have a real difficult time. I think that, I do think this was somewhat of an aberration as far as him missing weight, because he didn't look like he was, you know, he looked a little bigger than Max, but not like so much bigger than, like, well, golly, he's not even trying. It could have been sickness or whatever. Still, and again, this is a dude, like you said, he dominated Cowboy Cerrone, beat Gilbert, finished Cerrone, finished Melendez, finished Ben Henderson. But since that time,
it just seems so long ago, doesn't it?
That's the thing. With the exception of Cerrone, who's a madman, who's unlike any fighter almost ever, Melendez hasn't really looked great in recent years. Henderson's clearly, you hate to say somebody's done, it implies that they can't fight anymore, but he's not at the elite level. He's at a level below, and Pettis is probably in that range as well. You know, yes, he had a bunch of losses at lightweight, but, you know, it was, you know, former champions or future champions, and none of them were really blowouts for the most part. But I think he probably needs to fight more regularly than he does. And maybe fighting at 55, it's so weird because, again, this is a guy that, you know, he just took on Charles Oliveira and absolutely annihilated him. He walked through him like it was nothing. And Oliveira, when he's on, is special. Of course, when he's not, he's not. So
I thought the Oliveira fight was pretty competitive until he got that guillotine. Third, you thought he walked through him?
There were moments when he just seemed like he didn't give a shit about Oliveira. Like, I when I was rewatching it, like, he dropped him in the first round with body shots. Oliveira went for an armbar. Pettis just pulled it out and stepped away like, this is nothing. Like, when he had his back taken, Pettis was just calmly waiting for his opportunity to turn. I saw a guy, I'm like, wow, he's really mentally in control of everything that's happening in the cage. In this fight, who knows? Maybe, you know, he's probably partially a front runner. You know, breaking the hand probably threw him off to the point where he's like, I don't really know what to do here. I don't have all of my tools. But plus, it's just the fact that he lost to Max Holloway, which, yeah, that sucks.
Really, really good.
Yeah, this is the guy who's either the second or third best featherweight in the world, depending on where you look at Frankie Edgar. Like, it's not, and he went in there and he was competitive as hell. Those first two rounds were pretty close. So it's not like he got blitzed and knocked out in a second or anything like that. So sometimes, yeah, you can look at a guy's record and go, oh, look at all those losses. But when you really watch them all, it's like you can have all, what does he got? We'll say his last four losses, okay, with the exception of Holloway, most of those were, you know, maybe one round difference in each fight, and he's got three or four wins. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not fighting like, you know, Matt Hughes at the end of his career, where like, all right, Hughes is kind of going down. Chuck Liddell or any of these guys, like, he's right there where sometimes the narrative can overwhelm and it just kind of obscures the truth of how a guy's actually performing. And MMA, because so many weird things can happen in the sport, we see so many guys get knocked out by one punch out of nowhere. Matt Serra, George St. Pierre, the first fight, best example, where, you know, continued dominance really says more than anything. So we'll see, but I wouldn't you put odds on it. I don't see Pettis returning to the upper echelon in his career.
And a potential Holloway-Aldo fight? Who do you like?
Aldo. Yeah. I mean, the way Aldo looked with Edgar, he looked like the Aldo of old. Very, very crisp. Jose Aldo, you always have to be careful of recency bias with fighters.
Sure.
Yeah, he lost to Conor, but before the Conor fight, I mean, the dude was untouchable for a decade. He's got some of the greatest striking in MMA history. His takedown defense is incredible. His offense takedown-wise is incredible. And he's a legitimate world-class jiu-jitsu practitioner. And this guy is almost perfect. He just got dropped in 13 seconds by a crazy Irishman once. And, you know, who hasn't been there? He is older. He's had some injuries. But, you know, Jose Aldo to me is kind of one of those guys that I'm not betting against him, with the exception of maybe Conor, because Conor can get in your head. But I think Aldo is still right there at the upper echelon of anybody. And, you know, Holloway can match him in some regards, as far as like, if you're just like, if it was like point fighting, he could beat him. But the way that Aldo hits, he hurts people. Like, he damages people in the middle of fights. You don't just get slowly broken down. You get kicked once in the leg and it changes a whole fight. Jose's just, and he's so good at that. And, you know, I hate to count out Max Holloway because, you know, 57 wins in a row at featherweight is damn impressive no matter how you slice it. But so is 49-1 at featherweight if you're Jose Aldo. So I would favor Jose Aldo to beat Max Holloway.
Alrighty. In the semi-main event, Donald Cerrone beat Matt Brown by knockout with a head kick at 34 seconds in the third round. Fight was everything I anticipated it to be. Typical Cerrone Brown style, just throwing bombs, going at it. Cerrone starched Brown to end the fight, just a beautiful head kick. Brown almost kind of like went into it head first and it just flattened him. Exciting fight on most cards. This would have easily been fight of the night, but not in this situation because the fight prior to it was even better. What do you think of Cerrone's performance?
It was Donald Cerrone fighting. He fought a dude where he won the fight. He looked good doing it. The knockout was absolutely frightening. Like, Matt Brown doesn't get knocked out like that. And when they did a replay, and it was without the announcer, you just hear it. The sound of that kick landing on his jaw was frightening. It was so hard. As far as like, where does this put Matt Brown in MMA and stuff like that? I mean,
he's hit a rough patch, man. He had like that 6-fight win streak where he went on to fight Robbie Lawler and was like almost in the mix for, I think that was a title eliminator, if I remember. Like, if he had beat Robbie Lawler, he would have got a title shot. He was that close. Since he lost that Lawler fight, he's gone 1-5.
Yeah. I mean, Brown.
So, and he's older. He's 35, and in all his fights, he usually, I want to say, he gets his ass kicked for a good portion of the fight. But for a good portion of the fight, he takes a lot of lumps to get his own in. Sometimes it's, he'll take two to give one, I feel like. So, I mean, I like the guy. He reminds me of, like, I don't even know, like, this grizzled, old, like, sea captain or something. Just, like, a miserable bastard, you know? I find that endearing because there's not a lot of guys like that left anymore, kind of like in the Don Fry mold sort of thing. But, yeah, it's been a rough run for him. I don't know where he goes from here. But it seems like sky's the limit for Cerrone right now.
Yeah, Cerrone, you know, again, he beat Matt Brown. It was a kind of fight that if you're going to – before Cerrone started this year, you know, last year when at this time he was a lightweight before he went on to have, 50, what is this, 4 or 5 fights this year at welterweight, which is just absurd. If you were to tell me, you know, Donald Cerrone's going to fight at welterweight, who would be a good stylistic matchup, Matt Brown would be on the list. He's an aggressive fighter, strikes, but he's not that quick or powerful, and he doesn't wrestle all that great. So in that regard, you know, I didn't walk away from the fight going, damn, Donald Cerrone just keeps doing it again and again. Whereas when he fought Rick Story, I thought, wow, you know, Story is a guy that is a real welterweight, a big guy who uses muscle and wrestling, and he's got that, especially the wrestling, which is such a staple of the welterweight division historically. And when Cerrone, you know, just ran through him, I was like, damn, that's something. this fight, again, Cerrone did everything he was supposed to do. It was a great fight. I enjoyed the hell out of it. And like you said, it would have been fight of the night on most nights. But unfortunately, unfortunately for some people, this was a night where a lot of guys who would have had bonuses in the past just didn't get them, and that sucks for them, but it was great for us. But, Cerrone being the madman that he is, first thing he says is, I love this shit, and I want to fight in Denver, which is in January. And I've really never seen anything like it with Cerrone. You know, everybody kind of has this kind of attitude, oh, I'll fight anybody anytime, but this is a guy who's out there, he's legitimately put himself in, within 1 year, he moved into a weight class he never fought before and made himself a top five, top three contender in a year. That's almost unheard of. You know, even Conor McGregor took him a couple of years. Look at Max Holloway, it's taken him years. Most guys take a long time to work their way up there, and Cerrone is just walking through everybody. And, you know, I had thought of it, and then I saw that he confirmed my thought that he never heard, that he wants Damian Maia in Denver, which would just be on paper, that's the perfect fight to make. I feel bad for Maia because he's done everything he needs to do to earn a title shot. But at this point, almost so is Cerrone. Unfortunately, yeah.
Do you think that would be a bad fight for Maia though? Because I feel like Maya's big. Granted, it was 6-7 years ago now, but he was fighting for the middleweight title. He's a big 170 pounder, even though he's not like ripped like Jack. You don't look at him and say he's huge, but he's a big guy to be fighting Cerrone. I feel like he'd be able to take him down and kind of, I don't want to say tool him on the ground, but I could see it kind of going like the Condit fight a little bit.
Well, that's just it. It's like even guys who are, Condit obviously is a very solid welterweight, and we've seen what Maia in his current iteration has been able to do as far as just it's stunning. That said, if there's a guy to fight him, it's somebody like Cerrone. Because you need somebody who just says, ah, fuck it. I'm going to go out there and just kick you. I'm just going to punch you. You know, too many guys get worried about getting taken down. And Cerrone's kind of guys can be like, yeah, you took me now. Fuck it. I'll fight on the ground now. And maybe
yeah, he'll be going for triangles and everything. I mean, I can picture the fight. I just don't know. I just don't think Cerrone could hang with him on the ground. And I see it go to the ground.
He can't hang with him on the ground at all. And conversely, Maia can't hang with him on the feet. But also at this point, it's the only fight that I think is fair for either guy. Since, unfortunately, because of the dumb draw, Thompson and Wonderboy are going to fight. Thompson and Woodley are going to fight again, which, a good fight the first time. I don't mind seeing it again. But it does hold up the whole division. And then, if you're Maia and you have to have a fight, this is pretty much about the best fight you can take. Where you're going to fight somebody who's very credible, but who is not like, it's not like it's Robbie Lawler, where Lawler's got credibility, but that's a tough fight for Damian Maia. Johnny Hendricks or somebody like that, you go, ooh, I don't know. Like, I'd be a little nervous if I was Damian Maia about fighting somebody where the upside of beating them isn't that great, but there's a lot of great chance of losing. Versus Donald Cerrone, you're probably a favorite to win, and the worst case scenario, it's going to be entertaining. And if you're Cerrone, you don't think in these terms anyway. You just think in terms of, is there a warm body across me? I'm going to go beat the shit out of it. And frankly, if I'm Cerrone's management or whatever, knowing how he thinks, this is a fight for him to take. If he's going to fight anybody, I'd rather him fight a guy that will make him an undisputed challenger as opposed to, he's just going to go out there and be like, I don't know, is Eric Silva available? I'll fight him. I don't care. Yeah. Give me anybody.
There was talk of Masvidal, because Masvidal called him out after the Ellenberger foot fight.
Yeah, and again, that's a fight that if you tell Cerrone, hey, Masvidal wants to fight you, you'd be like, oh, okay, I'll do it. But Cerrone's got nothing to gain from that fight.
I agree.
Although I think he wins it, but still.
I agree. But part of my issue with Cerrone is I feel like he should be a much bigger star than he currently is. The guy's 12-1 in his last 13. He's won his last four fights in a division he shouldn't even be fighting in, all by finish. And it's like, he's got some charisma, and I don't want to say he has a gimmick, but he's got the cowboy thing and the, I don't know, the extreme sports, whatever you want to call that now, wakeboarding, skydiving, rock climbing, shooting guns, riding horses, whatever the hell he's got going on. Like, there's something there. And I think part of his issue with one is he loses fights at inopportune times. It's like he gets the fight against RDA and loses in the first round in a minute. So that's part of it. He has some losses there at bad times. But the other thing is he takes so many fights against, like, lesser names. If he sat out 4 or 5 months and waited for somebody to get hurt or pushed for a certain guy or called somebody in particular out, I think his career would be in a much, I want to say, better place now. But I think he'd have a lot more name recognition and more big money fights under his belt. Like, there's a reason Connor went with Nate Diaz instead of Cerrone. Cerrone was in that discussion too.
Yeah.
There's something there.
I know what you're saying. I think there's, you know, also keep in mind, we don't really know what Cerrone's true, I'll say, drawing power is. He's never really been put in that position. You know, right. He had that Dos Anjos fight, and I don't remember the ratings being terrible or blow away or anything like that. But there's also something to what makes Cerrone likable is the fact that he just fights all the time. Like, there's just something to seeing him. And I know that for most guys, you know, absence makes a heart grow fonder. Conor McGregor is actually kind of an example the other way, though. I mean, because he fights as much as any high-level guy has ever fought, I think. But, right. You know, Cerrone, you know, look, it's worked. The dude went out there, climbed the mountain at lightweight, lost. Most people would be like, oh, shit. Like, you know, Anthony Pettis loses, and look where he's at. Cerrone, 12 months later, he's at the top of the mountain, a weight class higher. And if he fights for the title, no, it's not going to be doing a million buys. But if he used to become welterweight champion, him versus Conor would be a massive fight. I think Cerrone is he's somebody that, with the right opponent, he will carry his side of the promotional weight. I don't think that he can drag someone across the line like Conor or Ronda can, but he's never going to be a liability drawing-wise. And, I mean, shit. The dude dresses like the Man in Black from Westworld is a legitimate... He's a real person. Like, there's, I think the more people get exposed to Down Cerrone, the more they like him. Because he's just genuine. He's out there, he's training in Cabo San Lucas because, fuck it, why not? You know, he built a gym in his garage. He visits his grandmother who he gives all of his money to in Denver. He openly admits that he's going to spend all of his money as far as he gets it. You know that when he's 50, he's going to live in a trailer down by a creek and he's going to be happy doing it. And there's something, you know, fun about that. Whereas, you know, Conor McGregor, his story ends as Saturday Night Live did in one of the worst skits ever. He's going to end up poor and broken and be like, oh, God, he's not happy because he can't live that way. Cerrone's going to be happy living in anonymity, shooting squirrels and eating rattlesnakes or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. I get it. I totally get it. He doesn't care and he just wants to fight and he wants to get that paycheck. I just think some of his paychecks could have been bigger if he had moved the chess pieces around the board a little more carefully. Like, I'm not going to be surprised at all if he fights Masvidal again. And granted, he should beat Masvidal, you would think, but you never know. Anything can happen in a fight. He loses to Masvidal, and all of this is for naught. Like, if I was managing Cerrone, I'd be like, you're either waiting for Robbie Lawler, Nick Diaz, or Maya.
Yeah.
I don't care which one, it doesn't matter when, but sit out a while, get one of them, and then you're going to get a title shot. You get the title shot, there's a potential Conor fight, and then you'll have all the money you ever need. You won't have to fight 10 more times in the next 3 years to get that one payday you would get if you just hung in there a little bit.
He's still going to keep going and fighting. It don't matter. You know, it's Cowboy. That's what makes him so great. Although, you know, you say it there. Damian Maia, that's a great fight. Nick Diaz is an even better fight because you'd have the storyline where Nate beat Cowboy style-wise. They match up perfectly. Nick always makes things entertaining. I can just, you know, after we saw Matt Brown, who I think, you know, is legitimately trying, you know, he's not faking, trying to do the mean mug thing. And Cowboy, I just see a guy, and I said it before his last fight also when he weighed in, where, like, it was so uncomfortable to watch a guy that relaxed, and this is someone that for a long time, and you know, people who've only been watching recently may not remember this, but especially back in the WEC, Cowboy's reputation was somebody of a slow starter. It took him a long, you know, he always lost the first round. He was seeing sports psychologists, all this stuff. He couldn't explain why he just wasn't doing well early on, and that's gone. And now he's just, Cowboy's in there. He's as relaxed as any fighter I've ever seen. He just, you know, for his own success in life, maybe he does have to fight all the time, and it doesn't matter who it is. Maybe that's the only way he ever has a chance to be a world champion is to fight Jorge Masvidal on 5 weeks' notice. You know, there are, everybody's different. Some guys need, you know, George St. Pierre needs 12 weeks and perfect nutrition and all this stuff, and Don Cerrone needs a 12-pack, a bunch of buddies, and in an open barn. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, since, where are we here? Since February of 2011, he's gotten 18-4 in the UFC. Like, he's unbelievable. But enough of us marking out for Donald Cerrone, I guess.
Let's fight somebody else.
Let's mark out over Cub Swanson beating Duho Choi by unanimous decision, 30-27, 30-27, 29-28. Wow. This fight was something else. Going into it, I mean, Choi had won a few fights against lower-level guys by knockout and had looked good doing so, but Cub Swanson was a major step up in competition. Swanson, I think, is ranked fourth in the featherweight division right now. And while he's never been a truly elite featherweight, he's always been a top 10 kind of guy his whole career. So I kind of thought Swanson would have his way with Choi, and that was not the case at all. Choi was super competitive. I had him win in the first round. He was rocking Swanson. And this was just a brawl where both guys took ungodly amounts of punishment, got rocked multiple times. The fight went to the ground. It got back up. Just a really exciting fight. One of the better fights you'll probably ever see. Possible fight of the year this year. Swanson ended up pulling it out. I noticed, I'm not sure if Rogan mentioned this or not, but somebody mentioned Jackson told him to kind of be more aggressive and pressure Choi after the first round, which is what he did. He kind of got Choi on his back foot and got him against the cage and did some damage there. And that strategy seemed to bear out in the second and third rounds, which is what got him the win.
Yeah, again, this is a fight that is difficult to overstate how great it was. I texted my brother this morning. I said, you have to download the show legally and watch this fight. It's easily one of the top five greatest fights I've ever seen. And he responded a couple hours later, holy shit, you weren't kidding. And again, I've watched it several times. When you first watch a fight, yes, the adrenaline kind of goes, you can tend to overstate and go, oh, that was the greatest thing I've ever seen. And then in hindsight, you're like, oh, well, okay, it was really good, but it wasn't as good. The second round of this fight, if somebody told me the second round of this fight was the greatest round of all time, I wouldn't argue with them. You know, there are very few fights that have ever been this good. You know, you can look at Duho Choi's fellow countryman, Korean Zombie, and I think Choi should be like the new Korean Zombie for his ability to take punishment and go forward. His fight with Leonard Garcia, was always been the greatest fight ever, along with Don Fry and Takayama. This fight, it had literally everything. That second round, I mean, usually you'll have great fights, and they'll be like, okay, there's a really great round. The other two rounds are okay. If you remove the second round, this still would have been fight of the night. It was that damn good. I mean, the first round was incredible. The third round would be something that people would be talking about for years because of just how awesome, especially the way it ended when Swanson landed a Superman punch and really stunned Choi. It was
hit him with like two cartwheel kicks.
Yeah,
like,
it was one of those things where Swanson has a quote-unquote unorthodox style, but and Choi is very conventional, but Swanson was either through luck or through perfect timing, ducking under everything Choi threw. Like Choi would throw a right hand, Swanson would duck under with a cartwheel kick and land it, and he almost finished him in the end of the third round. But then when you look at that second round, I can barely believe that it happened. I've seen rounds where guys get rocked and are hurt, then they kind of come back and they hurt the other guy, but this was a fight where within 45 seconds, either guy could have legitimately been stopped, and then they just kept going, and they did more and more, and they were both very injured. It wasn't just like that guy got a flash knockdown, and your adrenaline goes, but then he gets back up and he fights. It was like, no, Choi was almost out on his feet, but he somehow didn't die, and then for his troubles, he goes out there and he returns a favor, and all of a sudden Swanson's covering up, and he's ducking down, and he's almost out on his feet.
Multiple times.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again. It was unbelievable. There were so many times where I'm like, God, one of these guys is going down, and then they came back. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And it was, like, technical. It wasn't, like...
Sloppy. It wasn't stupid. It was. Yeah, they both used all the skills of MMA. They both... Again, Swanson fights in, people think, an unorthodox way, but it's not on accident. He does it deliberately. His movements, he purposely rolls with things. You know, as he goes back, he'll roll his shoulder to let the energy and the momentum of an opponent's punch come at him, and he uses that same movement to then do a spinning back fist. Like, everything had a point. These guys weren't just being stupid. And, you know, forget $50,000. These guys should be given $500,000 for this fight. It was truly that good. You can never ask for anything more. Swanson, and both after the fight, I mean, so surreal that during the first round, I think it was, the crowd starts chanting Do Hu Choi, which nobody saw that coming. I know Canada has a lot of Asians in it, but still, I mean, the Korean superboys are calling him. He was over like a motherfucker. Even his post-fight talk, he didn't speak any English, and people, everything he said to his translator, it just resonated, although it wasn't anything brilliant that said, I did like the, now I know what losing feels like, I'll fight 10 times harder to never feel this. Cub Swanson had this incredible speech about, not that he felt like disrespected, but more like, this guy called me out, and I wanted to show him, but show myself and show the world that I still got it. I can still be somebody. And it was real. It wasn't bullshit. It wasn't some guy, you know, coming up with a blah, 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 I hate this guy. It was like, this guy thought that he could challenge me and call me out because he thought he could beat me. Does the world, and it wasn't, again, it wasn't personal with Choi, is almost as if Swanson thought, the world thinks I'm not good enough. I have to go out there and prove to them that I'm still here. I'm still somebody. And it was, you know, getting genuinely personal for him. And he did it in one of the fights that will, I hope it's remembered forever. I don't think it will be, just because, one, it was on a show that a lot of people didn't see, and also the nature of the beast being that there's so many fights these days, and it wasn't an important fight. It wasn't Stephen Bonner and Forrest Griffin or anything like that. It was third from the top on a poorly purchased pay-per-view, but it absolutely deserves to be remembered in the annals of MMA with every single fight you can ever think of that was great. The only thing it didn't have was a drama of a title. Otherwise, this thing was absolute. I mean, again, I'm gushing over it. I will watch this thing over and over again for years to come.
Yeah, it was amazing. Fight went everywhere, went three rounds, they never stopped. To me, it's what MMA is all about. Prior to that, there was another match you probably liked the ending of, where Kelvin Gastelum defeated Tim Kennedy by TKO at 245 in the third round. Kind of a weird fight. I mean, Gastelum usually tries to fight at 170 pounds, but he's had trouble making weight. So he got bumped up to middleweight. UFC basically said, you got to fight at middleweight. This is ridiculous. You've missed weight at 170 too many times. And he was fighting Tim Kennedy, who is getting a little up there in years, obviously. Hadn't fought in 2 years. But still, Gastelum was coming up in weight against this tenured middleweight who's been competitive with, like, Yoel Romero and really, really good guys over the years. Gastelum just kind of walked through him. It was my take on it. And he did it in a way where he used his striking, which isn't really what he's known for. He's known more as a wrestler. Just really beat the crap out of Kennedy.
Yeah, I saw this as kind of a changing of the guard type of fight. I think Kennedy's done. I think, I mean, yeah, I'm a little biased because I don't I find the man annoying as shit. Even though he like Donald Cerrone and everyone else is apparently going to be leaving the association already. But, you know, Kennedy took 2 years off, and he's somebody that was late to the sport to begin with. He took 2 years off in your late 30s. He was old, and it showed. He didn't have the ability to keep up with Gastelum. There were times...
He was tired, too. I was like, I know he's always pretty jacked, but I felt like he was carrying more muscle than he ever has. I'm like, this guy, as soon as I saw him come out, I'm like, he's going to get tired quick, because it's one of those things where you're shredded like that and have big muscles, you get tired quicker because the blood needs to flow to the muscles, and it's just, you know, basic anatomy. But I was like, he's going to gas, and he did. He did, and it happened quick.
Oh, yeah, and not only did he gas, but there was a moment when I don't know if it was the first or second round, but I was watching, you know, obviously I was watching it, no, I was listening to it. When I could tell that Kennedy was going to lose, because the facial expression on Kelvin Gastelum was Kennedy had a go behind him. He was behind Gastelum while standing with a body lock. Gastelum didn't look, he was like almost looked bored. And there's a way that people will fight and grapple and compete where they can, you can get the feeling. And it's a problem that can never really be expressed to people. Like people kind of see a punch and they understand a punch. Grappling is such a very, very interpersonal endeavor that you kind of have to be there to understand it. You can feel when you're grappling with somebody when they're done. Like, there are times when you can just be grappling with a man and you can feel the wind go out of him. And it doesn't, and I don't know what it always looks like from afar, but when you're on the, in the shit, if you will, you can just tell this guy doesn't have it. And Gastelum showed the look on his face of, I know he doesn't have it. And he just kind of calmly didn't worry, boom, broke the grip, did a switch, got behind, got him down. And he just continued to take it to Kennedy. He was quicker. Kennedy had, yeah, he had size, but Kennedy, I was a little too short in stature for the 185 pounds. I never thought it was really the proper division for him. But I'm glad that he lost. And hey, let's just pretend that he lost because he hasn't won since USADA came around. So maybe you shouldn't be pulling guns on people, dickhead.
Gastelum at post-fight claimed he wanted to move back down to 170, despite looking so good at 185 tonight. He even said he would show up at Dana White's doorstep weighing 170 pounds to prove he could make the weight. He essentially claims that outside of camps, he gains a lot of weight. He doesn't watch his diet, but now he's learned his lesson. He's going to be more disciplined and not pack on the pounds. What do you think Gastelum should do? Should he stay at middleweight or try and get back down to 170?
I think he really should get down to 170. You just look at him frame-wise. He was kind of frame-ish. He was kind of there with Kennedy. Again, Kennedy's not a huge dude. And when you look at Kelvin Gastelum, think about him against Chris Weidman or Yoel Romero. Those guys are significantly bigger. Those are guys that have like 205-pound frames. And Gastelum, he really does look like he's got a 170-pound frame. I think he gets one more chance, maybe, at 170. If I'm the UFC, I say you can fight in 6 months, but in 3 months you have to weigh 170 pounds for 2 days. And we will monitor you and weigh you in for those 2 days or something like that. Anything to ensure that this guy really is going to make the weight. Because, you know, I don't think he's going to be able to compete with the very best at 185. At 170, I think he's going to give people issues. He's a young man.
There's 25.
It's weird because the older I get, the more I'm like, well, 25 is kind of young. But
no, that's young. But I wasn't saying it like he wasn't young.
No, I know, but it's like
25 and where he's at right now, it's pretty young.
Like, yes, you should know better because you're an adult, but there's life experiences that go on, and sometimes it doesn't always click right away. So maybe it takes him time. But again, he's had so many fucking failures making weight. He's just fucked up so many times that it's really difficult to give him the benefit of the doubt. But hey, if he wants to keep doing it, The kid's his ass in the line. Unfortunately, athletic commissions apparently won't suspend him if he fails to make weight. So, you know, really what you're doing is, it's not so much that you take a chance on him, is that you're taking a chance of fucking over another guy. And, you know, you can book him, and if, oh, he doesn't make the weight, well, he hurt himself. Yeah, but he also fucked down Cerrone out of a chance to fight in Madison Square Garden. And that's bullshit. Cerrone shouldn't have had to suffer that indignity. He should have been able to fight in Madison Square Garden because he begged for it. But, you know, Gastelum fucked him out of it. And that'll happen to his next opponent. It's to me, if I'm Dana or Sean Shelby, I think Friday or Saturday night was Joe Silva's last night, I would tell him, you're going to 170, fine. You're not getting a top 10 guy for at least a year. You got to prove not that you can compete, but that you can make the weight. And then you can fight at 170 for, you know, the real big boys. But otherwise, it's not fair to high-level guys that you are a risk for them to even have a fight. Or, conversely, you can fight Cole Miller. And Cole Miller will, you know, bitch and moan if he doesn't get the fight also. That'd be kind of funny.
In the opener of the pay-per-view, Emil Weber-Meek defeated Jordan Meehan by unanimous decision, 29-28 on all three cards. This was Meek's UFC debut, and it's actually the return of Jordan Meehan, who had retired, I want to say about a year ago. Any takeaways from that fight?
Just that Jordan Meehan, I think, was gone for like 17 months and contributed to retirement, whereas, you know, that was a shorter period of time than Tim Kennedy went between fights when he didn't retire. Otherwise, the fight sucked, and I don't care about it. I just don't. There's nothing
that's
to say.
Fair.
About
that's
it.
Great. No, that's good. Yeah. We can keep this moving. That's good. Then on the prelim card on Fox Sports 1, I did see all those fights. The one that stood out to me was Misha Cirkunov defeating Nikita Krylov. With a guillotine at 4:38 of the first round. Krylov was a pretty highly rated, you know, up and coming light heavyweight, had quite a few wins in the UFC. Not a name yet, but was the 8th ranked light heavyweight in the division and seemed to be a guy on the rise. Cirkunov was competitive with him everywhere and got that guillotine finish after hitting him with, I think it was like a left jab that just rocked Krylov. So now Cirkunov is 4-0 in the UFC, just beat a top 10 guy. All his wins in the UFC have been finishes. Granted, they're not elite-level light heavyweights, but definitely some promise there for Cirkunov.
Yeah, this was upset's not necessarily the right word, but coming out party. And that Misha Cirkunov is somebody that was just not on my radar as far as people I think of. Nikita Krylov has been good at light heavyweight. I don't want to say he's overrated, but I think that he stood out more because he started his career at heavyweight and he knocked out what's-his-face here in Chicago by a head kick. So he's kind of like, oh, wow, this guy did well at heavyweight. Now he's at light heavyweight, and he still continued to look good. But Misha Cirkunov was just bad. You know, whether it's a combination of Krylov having an off night, Cirkunov having the best night of his career, I don't know. But you go out there and you take on a dude who's a legitimate top 10, top 15 light heavyweight, and you finish him in the first round with a guillotine choke, you get credit for that. Like, in my book, like, that ain't nothing to fuck around with. That was a hell of a performance. So, you know, Misha Cirkunov, I just randomly pulling names out of my ass. I don't know why, but all of a sudden, I want to see him fight OSP. I don't know where that comes from, but it seems like two dudes are very good but not known and could use a win. So let's make it happen, Dana.
And then the other fight that caught my eye was Lando Vannata defeating John McDessie with a, I think it was like a wheel kick, by knockout at a minute 40 in the first round. Just like a highlight reel finish that probably a lot of people didn't see. This was on Fight Pass, but I think they also aired it at the end of the prelim card on Fox Sports 1. If you remember back, Vannata made his UFC debut on short notice against Tony Ferguson and gave Ferguson all he could handle for most of that fight and was really impressive for a guy most people had never heard of. So he got a win here and show some promise and some potential moving forward in the lightweight division.
Oh, absolutely. Again, yeah, like you said, he debuted against Tony Ferguson, who was in Sioux Falls of the card I almost went to, but I didn't. you know, John McDessie is somebody who, by reputation and performance, is a good striker who's very troublesome. He's unorthodox. And Lando is actually a wrestler initially. He's picked up the striking. The wheel kick that he hit was right out of Edson Barboza versus Terry Edom, Vitor Belfort versus Luke Rockhold. I use an animated GIF clip of that. Is exactly what it looked like. He timed it perfectly, just flattened McDessie with it. McDessie doesn't tend to get finished. He tends to have fights are kind of boring-ish because he's so difficult to figure out. Right place, right time, doesn't matter. All the credit in the world to Groovy Lando Vanetta, who got his nickname from Cub Swanson, as Joe Rogan kept pointing out. Just an absolutely stunning finish. I'm glad he got to 50 grand. I don't know, there's no way. Well, on any other card in the world, I never would have had any doubt. But this show, because of the incredible fight of the night and Donald Cerrone's amazing knockout, there was almost a little doubt. Could he actually not get this finish bonus, but he did. I do disagree with the idea that Max Holloway got the finish bonus. I thought that didn't make any sense. I thought Cerrone was just better. But you know what? You know, if you're in the main event...
And if they call it performance of the night, technically, because there's fight of the night, and then they give two performance of the nights now. So, I mean, there could be an argument that Holloway beat a better guy than Cerrone beat.
Yeah, and again, I don't really care, so long as Lando got his, because Lando... I mean, again, this is rare, incredible, just amazing finish as was the fight of the year candidate later on. Just one of those almost once in a lifetime, holy crap moments. But unfortunately, it's just going to be under the radar and most people will forget about it. But all credit in the world to Lando for knocking out a very tough dude in his home soil with an amazing wheel kick.
Yeah, good stuff. A lot of talks around in this show about Mike Goldberg and Joe Rogan possibly being replaced as broadcasters. The funniest part of the show, which made me laugh, was I think it was in the Cerrone fight where he finished Brown with the head kick. and Goldberg goes, and he finishes him with a body kick. And Rogan's like, no, it was a head kick. It was like it had already been played a couple times and Goldberg still fucked it up. I was like, oh my god. The day prior, Dana did an interview complimenting Rogan and how great he is, calling him the best commentator in combat sports history, basically gushing over Rogan, which we have also done numerous times. But it was glaringly obvious he did not mention Goldberg at all, and it seemed intentional, which lended credence to the idea that Goldberg is probably going to get axed in 2017. Do you think it's time for Goldberg to go? I mean, what are your thoughts on Goldberg as a commentator?
It's tough because I've written the same column in my head 20 times, never actually put a pen to paper about great commentators. I remember when Stephen Quadros and Bob Rutan did all the commentary for Pride, and together they were awesome. But once they separated, they were both significantly worse. Quadros would put in like a pseudo color man position. He wasn't nearly as good as playing kind of pseudo straight man. Boss didn't seem to click with his other buddies and compatriots or whatever. You know, the UFC's mix and matches a lot of their undercard low level announcers. You know, one day it's John Anik, one day it's Brian Stann or Kenny Florian or Dominic Cruz, whomever. I mean, Joe Rogan is by far the greatest thing that the UFC could have ever had. I mean, again, a guy who's a legitimate, high-level, world-class comedian who was also obsessed with the sport. I mean, it's basically like if you had me, but I was, like, one of the best comedians working around. So, yeah, it's... I just saw Lissa Sakara beat Joey Beltran. So Rogan's in the class by himself. That all said, there is sometimes, again, chemistry is so difficult to quantify. Mike Goldberg's job is not to be good. His job is to almost be invisible and to kind of make Rogan look good. It's kind of like a jobber in pro wrestling. You know, especially back in the 80s or whatever, you'd have these guys who, by reputation, people in the business knew, this guy's really, really good. But on TV, he just went out there and lost a lap, but he could make people look really great. Mike Goldberg.
Enhancement talent.
Basically, and I'm not saying that Mike Goldberg is an enhancement talent, because, again, Rogan can maybe do it with anybody, but they have a chemistry, and there's a timing that develops. It takes people a long time to develop that kind of, again, chemistry and timing. You know, you and I have been doing this for months now. We still haven't clicked 100%, but we've gotten better. I've done, you know, but we really have, and we've worked at it, and we kind of found a flow, and we kind of, okay, I can kind of pick up your ticks and cadence, and I know when you're trailing off and you're going to go into something. Okay, now it's my turn to talk. Oh, I can kind of tell he wants to talk right now. I should shut up, and so on. Goldberg and Rogan are very good with that. Goldberg, no, he's not really all that great. He says dumb things. Sometimes I think he tries to come across like he knows more than he does. You can always tell when he's learned something new because he starts talking about a teep over and over again. Like, oh, yeah, Mike Goldberg must have heard the word teep in practice or something like that. But at the same time, that's your voice. That's the voice of this company. And there's been so many changes to the UFC when you bring in this new ownership. If I'm ownership, I know you want to make your mark and you think you can improve things, but you better be really sure you can improve it because – one thing doesn't change the whole company. You know, you get rid of both those guys, UFC's not going to lose any pay-per-view buys. But it's losing both of them or one of them. It's doing something else. It's, you know, all of a sudden you go from a company that, you know, Lorenzo Fertitta's not involved in any of the negotiations. Joe Silva's gone. Mike Goldberg's gone. Just little things start adding up and, you know, it becomes Chinese water torture where you don't even realize it. Or, you know, no, it's actually more like boiling a frog. You know, if you do it, you know, just slowly increasing the heat, and people don't even realize that they're in, you know, boiling water until it's too late. And so, you know, I'm always very hesitant and nervous about that because, again, there's lots of really good play-by-play guys out there. Like, I was just thinking about this. Like, I was watching Michael Schiavello talk. I love Michael Schiavello. I think he's an awesome, awesome play-by-play guy. I think he's underappreciated. He should have a job in the UFC. I don't know if he would work with Joe Rogan. I think you need somebody to be mellow in comparison to Rogan when Rogan just freaks the fuck out and goes, holy shit, what am I, this is amazing. Like he goes into total mark mode and just loses his shit. Cause Rogan still does it. Even though he's like almost 50 years old, he still just gets up and goes crazy when he sees things. And you need a Goldberg type who's, again, he can hit his cues. He knows when to get out of the way. Yeah, he fucks things up a little bit here and there, but everybody does. He said he hit him with the body and was really to the head. He just probably just misspoke.
No, absolutely. And granted, you're everybody misspeaks sometimes. But there just seems to be like this growing resentment around Goldberg that he's like this bumbling fool, which I don't think is the case. But I feel like that rep has just kind of developed over the years for whatever reason, whether he screws up or people just don't think he's that knowledgeable, whatever it might be. But for me personally, I like them as a team. And when I hear them announcing, just the show feels more important, feels more significant, more historic. And I granted, this is UFC 206, but like when you're watching the prelims, like for whatever reason, it just draws my attention in a little more. It just says that the show matters. But again, that could be just from watching this stuff obsessively over the last, you know, couple decades, whatever it's been. So my mindset might be different. Would a casual fan ever notice the difference? Probably not. Would it necessarily be better? Probably not either. So I don't know. I don't know what difference it makes one way or the other. But for me personally, I like them.
Yeah, and I think there's just there's a credibility that they both bring. And it's an earned credibility. Because on the one hand, you know, everything I said about Rogan is true, but for your average person, they might go, dude from News Radio is the commentator? Like, really? Like,
Fear Factor. The Fear Factor.
Yeah, the Fear Factor guy is doing this? It doesn't make a lot of sense. But if you, it's kind of like Al Michaels and Frank Gifford. Like, there's just some guys who are, they become, I think it was Al Michaels and Frank Gifford, yeah. Monday Night Football, they become the standard, and that's what everybody remembers. And well, it's, you know, it's a combination of they were good plus member berries and things like that. Bringing somebody new, again, especially given that there's such a this overarching, some almost ubiquitous feel that permeates everything the company is doing right now, where even though it's hugely successful, the fights are, I mean, just gush for, you know, 5,000 hours about one of the greatest fights of all time. We just had one of the biggest pay-per-views ever. We're going to have another huge pay-per-view in a couple of weeks, which I'll be at live, everybody. Suck it. But underneath all that, there's just this constant talk of, hey, this UFC, $4.2 billion. It just keeps coming up. Fighters are talking about a post-fight. We're having weird little things, little changes here and there, and I feel like you don't fix something that's not broke. You know, if you buy a company for $4.2 billion, they clearly did something right to get it to that point. Now, yes, behind the scenes, you want to separate the wheat from the chaff, fine. I get it. You want to get rid of the guys that who are just, you know, like Chuck Liddell and Matt Hughes were just being on payroll because Dana likes them. I understand that. But the public product, you got to be careful. That said, again, WWE, they know what they're doing. They've done this. They're good at their job. If you can buy something for $4.2 billion, you clearly succeeded in life. I can't buy anything for $4.2 billion as much as I try. I put in an offer. I just didn't have any capital to back it up. And a really lucky dog just doesn't cut it, apparently, in Hollywood. So maybe in the long run it's better, but I don't trust it because MMA is, like any industry, MMA is unique. Pro wrestling is unique. Football is unique. Soccer, baseball, every sport, you know, art house films, blockbuster films. There's a talent to every type of, for every medium, and it has to be respected. You know, we can laugh at Michael Bay, but there's something that he does with Transformers that people just like. They don't want to, not everybody wants to watch, I don't know, King's Speech or something, to pull a random example out of fucking nowhere. You know, not everybody wants to see Silence with Martin Scorsese directing a film about a 17th century Catholic priest in Japan. Like, that does not appeal to everybody. I think it looks good, but most people want to go watch Optimus Prime transform and beat up another robot. Like, and I don't think Martin Scorsese could do it as well as Michael Bay could. He could probably do a really good job, but not as good. So you find people who are really good at what they do when they know their niche, and you just let them go free and do it. And it just seems to me, ever since the purchase, when I see Dana White talking, I don't see the passion as much. I don't see the fun in it. I think he still loves it. I think he still, you know, obviously he's doing it. But there just seems like he's holding back a little bit. Like, it's not quite the Dana of old, because, you know, I saw the interview he did with Michael Landsberg, and he kind of went off a little bit. But you could tell he wanted to be like, hey, that's something Lorenzo handles. But then he had to stop himself and be like, oh, wait, that's not what Lorenzo does. Lorenzo's not here.
He talked to the new CFO about that.
Exactly. And like, I don't even think Dana knows who's in charge. Just right. That, you know, he's there. And again, the business is booming. Everything looks great. But sometimes you're riding high and you're at the highest point, and you don't realize that it's not a slow slope down. It's a fucking ravine that you're coming to.
Speaking of Dana and interviews he was doing this weekend, there was a lot of talk. Almost every time he was interviewed, the Triple A came up. It seems like he's basically squashed the issue with Cerrone, and he's essentially said in every interview that, you know what, the fighters can do what they like, but be careful because you want to be aware of whose hand is in your pocket. Obviously, he's talking union dues and that sort of thing. And he brought up that, you know, the three different potential MMA unions or associations between Triple A, the PFA, and the MMA FA are all kind of feuding with each other, have lawsuits, cease and desist letters against one another. So he's kind of playing it off as a joke. He's basically saying he's not really that concerned about it, but be careful for Bjorn, or Bjork, as he affectionately likes to call him. Bjorn obviously is not responding well to that, and kind of gave an interview, gave Dana a bunch of shit about making $400 million in the sale and earning $20 million a year, and then paying the fighters shit. And he, this is a quote from the interview, and this is him talking about Dana. "That man is a gluttonous pig. He got $20 million a year on average before that to run the UFC. He's got the cojones to step up and to belittle Cowboy. How many fights did Dana have? How many times did Dana step into the cage in the WEC and in the UFC? But he made close to $400 million when the organization was sold. Please, are you kidding me?"
Fuck you, Bjork. All right, go on.
But to me, it's just getting, like, petty and personal, and it's one of those things that I don't want to say gives unions a bad name, but it's like, it's such a bad look. Why are you, like, calling the guy you're going to be negotiating with a pig on air in a public forum? Like, it's just a bad look. It's not good negotiating, and it's just going to lend more credence to Dana's argument not to have a union and keep things the way they are. Like, it's just dumb.
Bjorn Rebney being involved, everybody in the world from the moment it happened goes, wait, him? Where did that come from? Like, that's not right. Dana's, I think he's absolutely right about Bjorn Rebney. I don't know the man, but nobody has anything good to say about him. Like, nobody. And you can see, for those that followed it and for don't know, whatever, we'll probably clue you in a little. You know, Donald Cerrone basically said, "I didn't know I was going to be in a fucking board of directors. I don't want that shit." And Mac and Tim Kennedy's like, "I don't really like Rebney's public confrontational style, blah, blah." That's like two of your five guys, and Velasquez probably would have said something, but he wasn't really sure if he could speak English or Spanish well enough to get it across. And George St. Pierre isn't doing shit since he did all this, and he really, you know, St. Pierre's the one dropping the ball out of anybody. But it seems like you got a bunch of guys who are like, "Yes, look at this. We have these big names. They're going to be doing all this stuff," and they're all like, "Wait, what?" Like, I really feel like Rebney gotten, again, everybody listening, this is 100% conjecture. This is all speculation. I don't know.
Like usual.
Yes, but legally speaking, I'm just making shit up. It sounds like Rebney got in George St. Pierre's head and said, "Hey, why don't you call up some of your buddies and have them be there?" And St. Pierre's like, "Hey, Cowboy, this would be really fun. You have some, you know, we'll get, like, fighters' rights and things like this." And Cowboy's like, "Yeah, that sounds fucking good. Yeah, I'll go do that." And he shows up, and he's like, "Wait, what?" He literally publicly said, "I was blindsided by what happened that day." That's not...
He didn't even know Bjorn was involved until he got there.
Exactly. And for a project that Bjorn's supposedly been working on for 2+ years, fuck off. Like, it comes across as so low rent, such a scam. And not just a scam, but almost like everybody in the world sees it coming. And, you know, Rebney saying, "It's not a union. We're not a union. We're an association." What does that mean? "Well, we'll do this. We're not going to strike." Then he kind of half hints, "Maybe we'll strike." Then all the, like, half the people involved in the thing are like, "No." And then they fight in the UFC the next week without putting up any stink at all. Cerrone comes out and says, "You know, I talked to Dana White, man to man, the man was right about things." And I know people are going to think, "Oh, Dana White bullied Cerrone and stuff like that." And I'm sure there's some degree of that. Cerrone, I love the guy, but he's not a Rhodes Scholar. He probably could be sweet-talked a little bit, but there's also probably some truth the way Dana talks. Dana's very blunt and probably gave him the straight shit. And, you know, the whole thing is a general proposition. Edmund Tony and I have been talking about this for a while. It's like, a lot of these guys, they hear things and it sounds really good, but they don't understand. You can tell everybody we're going to have a pension. Well, where the fuck do these guys think that money's going to come from?
Right.
It's going to come from their pockets. And if you're Don Cerrone, a pension's a good idea because, you know, you're Don Cerrone and you need someone to make sure you're alive in 10 years. But, Tate, does she, I see she didn't tap, whatever. What's really dumb is Rebney's starting this little public feud here with Dana. He can't win because Dana's just, he's more likable than Bjorn Rebney, which says a lot about Rebney. And Dana's
just not freaking petty because it seems like Rebney is doing it just because he doesn't like Dana.
Yeah.
Like, the more he talks, the more he's out there, the more he buries himself and buries the whole association. And it's like, when he first was there, it raised eyebrows. But like, all right, they want somebody who knows the other side and can shed another perspective or whatever. It's like, all right. But now it's just like, it's petty, it's immature. And it's like, you're trying to negotiate with this company and you're going to call the president and most powerful guy in the company a gluttonous pig. It's like nobody in the NFLPA is calling what's his face?
Roger Goodell.
Maybe they should, but it's just, it's a bad look. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he's been watching too much national politics or something, but.
Well, that's true. It did work for Trump, so maybe it'll work for Rebney. But again, you're spot on with that. There's also the idea of, we touched on it earlier, we don't really know who the money man is that makes these decisions in the UFC right now. You can go after Dana all you want, but I don't know if Dana's the guy that negotiates it, or maybe it's Ari Emanuel or somebody else in WMEI. Like, it's a weird, an influx organizational structure. And again, you're talking Rebney, a guy who on day one said, we are not going to make contact with the UFC. Like, they had some weird idea, I guess, that he was going to organize it and the UFC would come crawling to them and talk, which, yeah, when you're negotiating, negotiation 101 is make the other guy make an offer first, but sometimes you're not in that position. Like, real negotiating 101 is know your strengths and weaknesses and know if you have a position of strength. Then when your plan is, there's a bunch of us and we're going to kind of do something, but we don't really know what we're going to do. And we're not going to tell you guys what we're going to do. And then a couple days later, half the guys involved go, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. I'm not even involved in any of this. I don't know what they're doing. I don't want to do that. This couldn't have been more of a joke if you'd planned it that way. Like, I think I said it to Tony, maybe you as well. It's like, you know, this thing's going to fall apart faster than anybody could have expected. And Tony, I think, said, well, you know, it fell apart. Could you really expect it to go longer than this? I said, well, I expect most attempts at organizations like this to at least make it to their second press release. And I don't even think they're going to make it that far. Like, it's
second press release might be that they're done.
Exactly. The second press release would be George St. Pierre sending an email going, oh, shit, guys, I didn't know what the hell was going on. I'm really sorry. Also, I think an alien did it. So, yeah. Fuck them all.
Speaking of athletes and how they handle their money and spend it, last night on Saturday Night Live, there was a terrible sketch on. John Cena was the host of the show. I only saw one sketch, so I shouldn't say Cena was bad on the show. But the reason I bring this up is they did a skit mocking dumb athletes who are bad with their money. One of the characters was supposed to be Conor McGregor, which it wasn't really well done. It wasn't really a very good Irish accent. I don't even know who the guy was who played McGregor. Did you see the sketch? Did you like it? Was it stupid? Does it mean McGregor's a bigger star than we thought? Is there anything worthwhile talking about with Saturday Night Live in 2016?
Well, there is, because Donald Trump thinks so. I mean, Saturday Night Live hasn't been funny for the majority of my life, and I'm 33. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of, it does say how big Conor McGregor is, that he's the go-to star. It's not Floyd Mayweather, it's not Mike Tyson, who would have been in the past. They had one of the guys, Keenan or whatever, I don't know, one of the black guys was playing some version of Charles Barkley, which was really a poor impersonation, and it wasn't funny, and it made no sense other than he kind of had a little bit of Barkley's affectations, but only for like about 30 seconds, and it kind of just fell away. The guy playing John Daly was okay. It was like they had Rob Gronkowski, John Cena's Rob Gronkowski, Conor McGregor, and John Daly. is like these athletes who've blown all their money. It's like, okay, John Daly's fine. He has blown a lot of money. But the other two are...
on slot machines.
Yeah.
And, how do you do that? How do you lose millions of dollars on slot machines?
Oh, that shit's addictive. My aunt, she always claimed that she won, but, you know, she was spending good, I mean, she got a lot of money, good six figures on slot machines in Vegas. Like, she would just sit there all day with a cigarette and a Red Bull and just play the slots. She's like, she was getting sweets at the Bellagio and stuff like that. So, yeah, like, I, you know, whenever I went to Vegas for a while there, I just went, hey, can I get a free room? She's like, yeah, I'll call up and get you a free room. I'm like, holy shit. So, it's really, yeah, that game.
Those were the days.
This was like 3 years ago. But yeah, I mean, this is why I think gambling is the most dangerous vice of them all. It's the only vice where occasionally it pays off. Like, if you're an alcoholic, the more you drink, the worse your life becomes. It doesn't, like, get momentarily better. Whereas with gambling, every once in a while, you get a little glimmer of hope of, yeah, look at that, I hit the jackpot, I got $10,000. And, you know, you forget about the other 20 grand you lost. So, I mean, gambling, man, that thing destroys lives in a way that few other vices do. But I digress. I mean, the skit itself was horrible. I mean, John Cena did his best with Rob Gronkowski. Cena's a funny dude. Gronkowski is an awesome human being himself. I'm sure you being in Boston, you know all about the Gronk.
Special.
I look at Gronkowski, I'm like, this is a dude that, like, he's not spending money in a stupid way. He's just, yeah, he's going out and partying and having fun on the boats with chicks and porn stars and taking his shirt off all the time. Like, he's just a rich bro is what he is, but whatever, he's not hurting anybody. He's not buying Tigers and shit like that. Connor's blown a lot of money, but he's got so much of it, and I don't think he's... I think so many of these guys nowadays have seen what's come before that they're not as susceptible to becoming Mike Tyson, where you've blown $300 million in your career and you have nothing. You know, again, John Daly worked, but holy shit, this wasn't funny. It was awkward and cringeworthy at times. The guy playing Conor McGregor, and they're talking about, like, hey, you need an IRA. I've been in the IRA ever since the Protestants came into my town. I'm like, really? That you're going with that kind of joke, which, one, isn't topical. Two, most people will get. Three, doesn't make any sense. The fucking Protestants and the IRA never exist in fucking Dublin, you moron. Like, it was awful. I don't know who the guy playing Conor was. There was a horrible Irish brogue. And I say this as somebody who's been given a lot of shit over the years from my fake Irish accent, but at least mine, I've heard, is okay if you're doing a fake Belfast accent. This guy he barely even kept character. He had no funny lines. He didn't look like Connor. He didn't act like Connor. The only guy in the whole skit that looked like anything was Cena as Gronkowski, because at least I picture, yeah, big jacked up boy with a short haircut from New England. Yeah, that sounds about right. That looks like Gronk a little bit. And, you know, Gronk is just the personification of a puppy dog come to life. He's a golden retriever walking around in human form. So that worked. But otherwise, this was horrible. I mean, fuck. This shouldn't be allowed on TV. You and I have made more people laugh in the past hour and a half here than Saturday Night Live did, and, you know, we're not professional comedians, and we're just doing shit off the cuff. So, you know what? Donald Trump, you're right. Saturday Night Live sucks. Keep it up. Keep tweeting about these idiots. Don't worry about anything else going on in the world. Don't worry about Iran or Saudi Arabia. Focus on Saturday Night Live. That's the real enemy out there, because they're making life worse for all of us.
There's another guy who's likely going to be on Twitter again soon. John Jones was officially given a one-year suspension by the Nevada Athletic Commission. This essentially reaffirmed the suspension given by USADA. There had been a question, would Nevada follow that suspension? Because you never know what Nevada is going to do. So in theory, Jones should be able to fight again next July. Of course, this is barring any extenuating circumstances. Do you think John Jones will be in a UFC cage next July?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that the UFC will time their mega international fight week to coincide with Jones's return, and If he doesn't fight July, he fights August. I think they'll get Jones back in the cage as soon as possible.
I guess what I'm asking is, do you think he'll fuck up again?
That's always a possibility. But
yeah, that's more what I meant. I didn't mean would they would they schedule him. Obviously, they if they can get him in July, they will. But I'm saying, will there be another drug test failure or, you know, another arrest or just something stupid happening that
you
can't foresee? What are the odds?
When you're a man and you have a dick as big as John Jones has, apparently, you get in trouble. You know,
but it's not really working well anymore, right?
Well, again, but it's just so big that he's going to – it overwhelms everything he does in life. I think he fights again. I mean, that's not going out of my way.
He'll stay out of trouble for the next 7 months.
Because you know what? He basically did before, and then he got popped for, what he claims is a dick bill. But other than that, you know, he had that one run-in with the cops. You call him a dumb pig and shit like that. But, since July, he hasn't made any news. That's pretty good. That's almost 5 months. That's a great run for John Jones. And there is still the fact that he lives in New Mexico. It's really difficult to get in trouble in New Mexico. They're just not in – he's not in New York. There's only so many strip clubs in Albuquerque, I'm sure. So I don't think John Jones can do too much damage. Oh, having said all that, after watching that fucking interview a second time with Joe Rogan, this guy is clearly going to fuck up again. Like, he is not with it. He has no clue what's going on in the world. He is doomed to repeat his mistakes until he has nothing, or until God blesses him with a boy because he gets married. He's mature, responsible then.
Also in John Jones news right now, as we're talking, he's getting ready to step in. Is it a cage? What do they do in Submission Underground? I think it's a cage.
I have no idea. I presume it's just a mat. I've never actually seen Submission Underground.
I feel like the first one was in a cage. I picture Vinny Magalesh in a cage for some reason. I could be wrong. He's taking on Dan Henderson in that submission grappling match on everyone's favorite website, Flow Sports. Jones should just walk through Henderson, right, Mollum?
I presume so, yeah. I mean, he's just so much bigger. That he's bigger, he's younger, he's stronger, he's faster. He's got a better submission grappling game as a general rule.
Yeah, like I'm trying to think offhand. When has Henderson won a fight by submission ever? Not to put you on the spot, but I don't know the answer myself.
Yeah, going through things. Maybe he pulled off a guillotine or something one time, but early in his career.
Okay. But, I mean, it's not like he's
got a computer.
I'm working on it. But it's not like he's some submission whiz in MMA. Granted, he's got the Olympic wrestling background, you know. But I'm trying to think offhand. It's like I feel like he's mostly, for most of his career, at least in the latter stages, been more of a striker and kept it standing. He either wins by knockout or he gets knocked out. I mean, those are kind of the only two options.
That and his submission grappling isn't bad, but it's very positional based. And which isn't bad. I myself, obviously, I'm at the level of Dan Henderson. I'm a positional based grappler. I don't always get lots of submissions, but I know how to get to certain positions and keep them and things like that. There are certain guys who are really good at grabbing submissions from anywhere. The Submission Underground uses a Eddie Bravo Invitational rules, which I think are fine for entertainment value. I think they're bad for jiu-jitsu skills, but they over emphasize submissions, which I don't think is proper. But I'm trying to think if Dan's got. I feel like I've seen him try a guillotine at least. But
the last true submission win he had was in 1997. Yeah, standing guillotine against Eric Smith in the Brazil Open in 1997.
Yeah.
I'm picking John Jones.
Yeah, I'm picking him, and no one's going to give a shit. Like, nobody's going to care at all. And, hey, good for you, Flo. Keep spending your money. We'll see you in the ash heap of history, along with WCW and Enron and every other fucking dumbass group.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the most cost-effective thing. Although, I mean, you would think John Jones is like the third or fourth biggest draw in the UFC, even when he's not around. You would think this would get some buzz, but I'm hearing very little about it.
It's submission grappling on the internet.
I'm with you, but you would think, even like in MMA circles, like, I don't see a lot about it. I'm scrolling through Twitter right now, and there's not much talk about it at all.
It's because it's a joke. That's why. Okay. I mean,
Flo, well, there's a lot of jokes.
Flo is a money pit. It's a scam. Some carnies behind it or something like that. All conjecture, I know. But, I mean, it's a fucking company that's trying to make money selling, you know, live feeds of college gymnastics. I'm sorry. Right. That ain't going to cut it. And I love jiu-jitsu as much as anybody. I want to see the IBJJF World Championships, and I have a lot of problems with the IBJJF. I think it's not always a fair organization. It has issues. That said, when it comes to gi grappling, there is nothing more prestigious, and when it comes to no gi grappling, it's Abu Dhabi. You guys can try to create anything else you want. I'll watch Eddie Bravo stuff. It's fun. It's entertaining. I don't know if I need Eddie Bravo 2.0. With Chael Sonnen running things of all people or whatever. Like, it's just, no one, it's fucking stupid, it's a waste of time. So, just fuck them. Yeah, there's my commentary. Fuck them.
Good. So this weekend, I think that covers this week. This weekend, we're gonna jump ahead. Obviously, this is a special circle.
I got your message.
Because, we're doing the show on a Sunday night. Normally we would do it on a Wednesday night.
Which we cannot say why. Yes.
This is going to be it's my fault. This is going to be a very early preview of, Bellator 169, which no one will watch. It's from Dublin, Ireland on Spike TV. The main event is King Mo versus Satoshi Ishii, or Ishii. Depending on how you like it.
It's Ishii, yeah.
Yeah, it's one too many eyes for me. Very thin undercard, really nothing underneath.
One too many eyes for me. That's not what the Cyclops said. Anyways, go on.
Daniel Weichel's really the only other name on the undercard. King Mo's got to be the favorite going against Ishii at this point.
Yeah, Ishii's been the disappointment. A world-class judoka and gold medal winner. It seemed to try in earnest to make the transition. MMA went to American Top Team. He's had some moments here and there where he looked good, but he's just not a fighter. And, I mean, King Mo ain't very good either, actually, but who gives a fuck? It's a fucking Bellator in Dublin.
But of all the main events, why would you put that on in Dublin? I get maybe you can't get a name Irish fighter. I get that, but that's such an odd fight. One of those guys would be a draw or care about fighting. They're both flying halfway across the world to go fight on this Bellator show that nobody's going to watch. It's odd.
There's a simple explanation. It's like a World's Fair back in the days when people were racist, when they brought in the African and the Japanese man. People, ooh, look at the foreigners. Ireland has nothing but pasty white people, so they'll be, ooh, and, look at the slanty eye guy. Look at the Negro. So that's all it is. They're just showing off different races that the Irish people don't get to see. That's all this is. It's a fucking freak show. Bellator's a racist organization on par with the 1908 World's Fair in St. Louis.
Fair enough.
Which is one of the greatest World's Fairs. 1908 Olympics in St. Louis, which is one of the greatest Olympic events of all time. Everybody needs to look it up and read the Wikipedia about the, in particular, the marathon, which is amazing.
Okay.
Do you know anything about that?
I am not familiar with the 1908 Olympics. Olympic marathon, no.
Oh my gosh.
Did anyone shit themselves? I like it when that happens in marathons.
Well, what happened was they had
Are you familiar with that? That seems to happen in the Boston you shouldn't talk about the Boston Marathon around here, but oftentimes people shit themselves during the Boston Marathon.
Yeah, I've seen that happen. No, I think it's 1908. It was the Olympics in St. Louis, early 1900s. It was a complete shit show. They had the marathon. The first guy that won got disqualified because it turned out that he had just wandered off the course and cut.
Yeah. That's always a good trick.
They had one guy who would have done better, except for he had been given a combination of cocaine and strychnine because it's halfway through because they thought that would help him out. They brought in two guys from Africa who were originally part of like a freak show, but they just had them run. One of them said that he would have done better, but he didn't have any shoes. The other one would have done better, except for he got chased a mile off the course by wild dogs. There was one guy who took a nap partway through the marathon, and it is absolutely like, oh, fuck this shit. Keep talking. I'm going to look this shit up because it has to be read on air in detail. It's one of the greatest things you'll ever hear in your life. It's such this incredible tale of fucked upness and St. Louis. I fucked up that spelling.
So, hey, I'm basically looking at results of this Submission Underground 2 thing. And the funniest thing I've ever seen, somebody writes, at Jeremy Bonner, nowhere we can get a live stream for free. And he writes back, you're kidding me, right? You know I work for Flow Sports. Best thing ever.
Oh, it's the 1904 Olympics. How the fuck did I get that close to it? That's really sad. 1904 Summer Olympics Marathon. It was in St. Louis. I'm at Wikipedia. Let's go through the thing. The first to arrive at the finish line was American runner Fred Lorenz, who had actually dropped out of the race after 9 miles and hitched a ride in the back to the stadium in a car, waving spectators and runners alike during the ride. When the car broke down to the 19th mile, Lorenz re-entered the race and jogged across the finish line. Hailed as a winner, he had his photograph taken with Alice Roosevelt, daughter of then-President Teddy Roosevelt, and was about to be awarded with the gold medal when his subterfuge was revealed. Lorenz immediately admitted what he had done, said he had only been joking. The AAU responded by banning him from competition for life, although they reconsidered and lifted the ban a year later. British-born Tom Hicks of the United States ended up as the winner of the event, although he was aided by measures that would not have been permitted in later years. 10 miles from the finish, Hicks led the race by a mile and a half, but he had to be restrained from stopping and laying down by his trainers. From then until the end of the race, Hicks received several doses of strychnine, a common rat poison, which stimulates a nervous system, mixed with brandy. He was supported by his trainers when he crossed the finish, but was still considered a winner. Hicks had to be carried off the track and might have died at the stadium if he had not been treated by several doctors. Another near fatality during the event was William Garcia of San Francisco. He was found lying in the road along the marathon course with several internal injuries caused by breathing the clouds of dust kicked up by race officials' cars. A Cuban postman named Adrian Carvalho joined the marathon, arriving in the last minute. After losing all of his money in New Orleans, he hitchhiked to St. Louis and had to run in street clothes for the event and he cut off around the legs to make them look like shorts. Not having eaten in 40 hours, he stopped off in an orchard en route to have a snack on some apples, which turned out to be rotten. The rotten apples caused him to have strong stomach cramps. Despite falling ill from the apples, he finished in fourth place. The marathon included the first two black Africans to compete in the Olympics. Two Setswana tribesmen, Len Tao and Yamasani, they were not in St. Louis to compete in the Olympics, however. They were actually part of a sideshow. They had been brought over by the exposition as part of the Boer War exhibit. Both were actually really students of the Orange Free State in South Africa, but this fact was not made known to the public. Len Tao finished ninth, and Yamasani finished 12th. This was a disappointment, as many observers were sure that Len Tao could have done better if he had not been chased nearly a mile off course by aggressive dogs. Arriving without correct documents, Frenchman Albert Corey was not included as part of the French team. He is inconsistently listed as performing in the mixed team in the 4-mile race and performing for the United States in the marathon. So yes, the 1904 Olympics in St. Louis, the marathon, one of the greatest things ever happened in the history of sport. I'm surprised that the Japanese have not tried to recreate it for their modern-day New Year's Eve show with Bob Sapp.
That is something else. The olden day, people complain about...
How the fuck did I remember all of that off the top of my head?
That is odd. But it's even funnier, though, because people complain about Korean sports and the world now. You look back and you hear something like that. Like, the dirty water in Brazil doesn't seem that bad, does it?
Not when you're, back then, doping consisted of taking rat poison.
Yeah.
getting shit. I just want to see fucking Olympics where one day a guy's running on the 25th mile and a bunch of wild dogs chase him off the track and nobody's like, yeah, that seems like it's unfair. Like, nah, just let it go on. Just keep on going by.
The marathon would be a lot more of a spectator sport and a lot more popular if wild dogs actually chased all the runners.
I think it'd be better if they had sticks and they could hit each other.
Need something. Give me a prediction for Jones and Henderson just ended. What's your prediction for a finish?
Jones by Darstroke.
Arm triangle.
Close enough.
Yeah, it sounds like you got Mountain got an arm triangle with about a minute left. So we finally have a conclusion to UFC 151. So we talked Bellator on Friday. There's also a UFC show on Saturday. We're just getting bombarded with shows here after that dry spell for 3 weeks. So on Saturday, December 17th from Sacramento, California, we have UFC on Fox, headlined by Paige VanZant versus Michelle Waterson. Thoughts on that fight?
They're both cute.
Okay.
That's why they've been put in this position.
You're really going out on a limb here.
Paige should probably... I would think Paige...
That's a hot take.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a hot take. Yeah. Hot, sexy. Paige should win because she's just naturally bigger than Michelle. They're both in their position because of their looks. Not that they're not bad fighters or anything. Like, they're both solid. So probably better than they should be. Especially Paige. Michelle's been a little under the radar, so she probably actually had to really work hard. But she's still a natural atom weight. And when your natural weight class involves the word atom, you're not going to do well when you fight adult human beings. So I think Paige probably wins it by TKO.
Yeah, I think Paige is going to be too big for her. And I think Watterson's been on the shelf a while, too. I don't know if she had a kid or there's some reason she hasn't fought in a long time. She might have had a kid. I don't know for sure, but the last time...
Women do that sometimes.
Yep, sometimes they get pregnant.
And then they turn the toilet seat blue.
I don't know what that means.
I saw something, apparently it's a real thing, where pregnant women will turn a toilet seat blue in the third trimester because of, I don't know, something to do with their hormones or something like that. Like, it's not... like a one-off thing. Like, you go Google it. Pregnant women.
How does a white plastic toilet seat turn blue?
I don't know how anything works with fucking pregnancy. I think
you got worked.
No, I did not get worked. I fucking looked it up. I read real sources. Like, more than one person.
Breitbart? Was this on Breitbart or something?
Like, they would ever talk about women's health. No, like, it really happened. Like, I did something to do with secretions or okay. Hormones.
I've never heard that one, but I believe you heard it.
That's fair.
But yeah, the karate hottie there hasn't fought since July of 2015 when she beat Angela Magana in the third round. So it's been a while for Watterson. Had quite the layoff, and obviously Paige is a little bigger, been a little more active. I mean, Paige seems like she should be the favorite in that fight. And my most anticipated matchup of the show in the you could call this one a co-main.
Yeah,
you could. You've got Sage Northcutt versus Mickey Gall. I like Gall in this fight. I think he can take Northcutt to the ground. And we've seen Northcutt and his ground game. It is unrefined, to say the least. That Barbarina loss, where he lost with that arm triangle where it didn't even look like it was synced in, was pretty telling. Also, this fight's going to be at welterweight, so... Again, it might not really be Northcutt's natural weight class, but in Northcutt's defense, it kind of makes sense to fight Gall because he's got a little bit of a name coming off the CM Punk win, and he's also not that experienced. And it's like, how many guys with a name and very little experience are there for Northcutt to face? So it was kind of a tactical fight for both guys, with Gall calling out Northcutt, who doesn't seem like he's that great a fighter yet. Kind of made sense all around, but personally, I got to go with Gall.
Yeah, obviously, Mickey Gall is a friend of the show. At 170, I think the weight is probably the biggest difference here. Gall is very good on the ground, we've seen, not just because he beat CM Punk, but in general. Sage has shown a weakness at times with his ground game. You know, long run, long term, as much as I want to, you know, rip on Sage Northcutt because I, you know, I call him he's a fucking golden retriever. He's so happy. Everybody subscribe to Fight Pass, blah, blah, blah. The dude's only, he was only like 19 in the UFC. I don't think he's 21 by now. Maybe he's 21. He's still really young. He has a lot of skills and incredible athleticism. Like, there's a reason to look at this guy and think potential. And I don't think that, moving up to 170 to fight somebody like Mickey Gall, who is really someone that's a difficult fight for him. But at the same time, I think they're both very evenly matched skill-wise. You know, Gall striking, it's passable. I think Sage is better. He's certainly more dynamic. On the ground, Gall is, I feel very comfortable saying, much better. And I think that the biggest difference is that... basically, that I get distracted because some idiot sent me a message on Facebook.
I thought you could multitask.
I can, but I also have the TV going and I'm petting a dog, so it's like too many tasks.
Focus on the dog.
Yeah, well, this dog has plenty of fucking focus. I really think the biggest thing for Gall is that because he's fighting somebody smaller than him naturally. Whatever deficiencies he has as far as takedowns would go at 170, where, you know, if he fought a Johnny Hendricks or somebody where they could be stifled, he can get Sage down. And once he's down, Gall has very good pressure, very technical, and I think he's going to tap out Sage Northcutt.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely. Then in a bantamweight fight, what is supposed to be... I mean, Faber announced this was going to be his last fight. We've got Uriah Faber versus Brad Pickett. Pickett, another guy who this could be his last fight as well. I think Pickett's looked worse recently. He's got that last loss. I don't know if it was a son, maybe Alcantara. But either way, I like Faber. It would be a good send-off for him. It's in Sacramento. It's his hometown. Maybe he can pull out a win here. Against a guy who's a little older than him, probably a little slower and a little more banged up.
Yeah, it's Faber's supposed send-off. I think it's going to be his last fight. There's always a danger when a guy goes into a fight thinking to himself, this is my last fight, because sometimes they don't have that fire to train as hard as you need to. Like, you really need to train so hard that it's killing you. And if you know you're going to retire, you might say, fuck it, it's my last fight. I'm taking this Sunday off to go spend time with my kids or wife. Faber doesn't have any of those, as far as I know. But, you know, maybe he went surfing or something like that, or whatever midgets do in their free time. They go to Brazilian steakhouses with me. which is fun. But Faber should be favored to beat Brad Pickett under any circumstances. He's historically been inconsistently been many steps above Brad Pickett. Brad Pickett's a guy that's been as low as 125. He's been good at 35. Faber's a guy who's a champion at 45. Championship caliber at 35. Should be Faber's fight to win. I don't think he gets the finish. I think that they're both almost incapable of a finish now. Although Faber could always grab a guillotine. And I hope he does. I hope Faber grabs a guillotine and gets that last win there in his hometown. It's a storybook. It is a storybook ending. Not everybody gets an MMA. It's almost too perfect, and sometimes maybe guys plan for this perfect ending and it doesn't work out. But for Faber's sake, I hope it does. You know, we saw earlier this year Mark Munoz got his last victory there in the Philippines in front of his ancestral home, so maybe Faber gets it with Pickett. But, you know, again, taking all the X factors, all that shit, I mean, Faber's is better than Brad Pickett. That's just what it comes down to. And Faber he's a guy that is slowly declined. He didn't fall off the cliff. He just kind of went from level 10 to level 9.5 to 9 to 8.5 to 8 to 7.5 to 7. Like, he's still good, and he's good enough that if he wanted to, he could keep fighting and probably take a lot of beatings. That he's going to retire. I presume he's got enough money, enough future endeavors, so to speak, to keep him busy. And good for him if he gets out now before he takes too much damage. He's never really seemed to take the damage to the head. I'm still unsure of how he can walk after the Aldo fight, but, you know, I hope he gets a win. He's a really nice guy. He was always really cool to me. I told the story many a time. He came here in Chicago several years ago as a favor to my friend Daniel. Did a seminar, me, Daniel, and Faber, a couple other people. We all went to Brazilian Steakhouse. Faber was really nice. Afterwards, we did a seminar. We were going to do some private training with Carlson Gracie Jr. And Faber himself was like, hey, why don't you come over and train? I'm like, holy shit, yeah, I'll fucking come and train. And I rolled with Faber for 10 minutes. And I thought I did it good at the time. In hindsight, I'm like, oh, yeah, he was just fucking with me. Yeah. But again, you know, this dude, he was a world-class fighter at his peak, in the middle of getting ready for a fight. He has some legitimate training that day, and he took, you know, like 5 minutes out of his day to roll with some jackass like me, and I can always...
Did you tell him the story about the 1904 marathon?
No, but I should have mentioned the story about Joseph Benavides hating me for some reason, but...
That would have been good.
Yeah, but
Faber would be like, he does that to everybody. Don't sweat it.
Actually, I'm kind of curious about that because Benavidez, prior to his fight, last fight with Cejudo, you know, they show clips of him training in Colorado. I've seen some things with Chad Mendes up there.
I think the only guy really left is Garbrandt.
That's the maybe Paige is still there at Alpha Male full time. I don't know.
It was weird. She pulled out of there at one point too. She might be back though.
Well, probably because she was banging, you know,
Garbrandt
people on the team. People's plural. I don't know. It's an odd situation. Like, and I don't blame the guys for going up to Team Elevation. It's a great camp. Dwayne Ludwig knows what he's doing. Get the elevated atmosphere of Denver, but I don't know, it's just kind of this awkward, like, two camps that are cousins to each other, but they hate each other. They're like the Hatfield and McCoys if they were married somehow, and it's just a very odd thing where if Faber and probably, I guess, TJ could make up somehow, they'd have this really great connection, and I really think it's important for camps to have that. Like, I know that Rufus Sport has it somewhat with Greg Jackson. They have it a little with American Top Team. I think it's really good for camps to have relationships with other camps so that their guys can cross-train. They can go to a different camp in case they have to fight somebody from within their normal training camp. But
do you know what the deal is there? I mean, does Faber get like a cut of their purses if he's if they're living in his houses and training there or whatever? Because I don't want to say it seems like what is that thing with the sister wives, the Mormons, and the compounds. But like to me, it almost had that kind of feel where it was like they're all living in these houses right next door to each other, and Faber bought them all, and he's getting a cut of their purse. Is any of that like true, or am I just making that up in my head?
I don't know it for a fact that it's true in the sense that like, I haven't discussed it, but my impression is that that's probably somewhat accurate. But I don't think that Faber did it, or continues to do it from a Bjorn Rebney point of view. Like he's actively saying, I can take advantage of these dumbasses, so much as he thought this is a good way to make, you know, to do a future. And he was always looking ahead.
Yeah, no, he's a businessman. I'm not saying it's bad, but I wonder if there's some resentment there from some of those guys, whether it's like, are they paying rent or is it rent free and he gets a cut? Like, I don't know what it is, so it's hard for me to really judge it and have an opinion on it. But I've always heard like he got a cut of what they made in the UFC, almost like he was their manager.
I'm sure he did.
In addition to their landlord, in addition to probably you could call him a head trainer. I know he was never the head coach of Team Alpha Male, I don't think. They always brought in, a lightweight or
Justin Buchholz right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that, I'm sure, I don't say I'm sure, I would be willing to bet that Faber has some sort of management cut that he gets. At the same time, you know, it's like anything where more and more gyms are understanding this model. And I think Faber may have been ahead of the game, because I know that TriStar has that now. You know, TriStar has room and board for people. They want to come and train. Some of them pay. Some of them give a cut of their purse or whatever. But they have essentially dorms or, you know, modified little mini apartments for people to live at. I'm sure Greg Jackson has it. American Top Team. I'm pretty sure Ruby Sport doesn't, but it would make sense. And, you know, then you just, after that, it really just becomes any tired and played out argument of management versus, you know, workers, as far as, you know, Faber put up a lot of capital in the beginning. He risked a lot with no guarantee of reward. People come in, they have nothing. You know, you'll get to my TJ Dillashaw, just a fucking good but not great wrestler, and Faber took him under his wing and turned him into probably a millionaire. At the same time, there's five other guys Faber did that with that he didn't get a dime from. And, you know, people are like, oh, he's taking all this money from the guy. But it's like, yeah, but he nurtured it. And he kind of, you know, he put up the capital. He made the investment. And, you know.
Yeah, I mean, my impression has always been it's like any, I want to say any business, but a lot of the times the people, you know, you don't want to say workers, but the people underneath, get resentful of the person who's making all the money. I mean, it's just natural, and people get jealous. So I wonder if a lot of those guys jump ship because they felt like, why are we paying this guy money? We should be keeping all of our purse. Let's bail and get out of here. Because, I mean, Team Alpha Male is essentially disintegrated at this point.
Yeah, and that's probably fair, and that's part of the natural way of life. And I think a lot of businessmen kind of understand that. It's like this unrelated but related. I saw a commercial today and I've been laughing at it. The McDonald's says, we're the best first job you'll ever have. So they're actively, you know, telling people, like, we acknowledge that you're working minimum wage or whatever, but it's a good starting position. You can move up. And it's true. In McDonald's, there's a lot of opportunities for growth. They tend to promote from within. They're franchised out, but they're pretty good about helping out people. But it's still a first job. I kind of laughed because I thought, what if you're like fucking 40 years old and applying to work at McDonald's and they're bragging, this is a job for 15-year-olds. But they acknowledge that this is your first job. This is not where you will end up. This is where you start. And I think sometimes people on the management side think, well, you started there, but I helped you so much. And they did. They took a risk because a lot of these guys don't pan out. For every Cody Garbrandt and TJ Dillashaw, there's five other guys you never heard of. But I think management sometimes need to acknowledge that you got the return on your investment at a certain point. And after that point, the guy's going to be like, I don't think this is kosher. I think I should be getting more. And yes, everybody always wants to, you know, invest in the penny stock that became Google. You become a billionaire. And that happens sometimes. But, you know, in the world of fighting, even setting aside the money, a lot of guys need to move around just for their own physical development. And again, that's why I go back to the whole idea of needing multiple, you know, relationships so guys can go around. I always use Rufus Sport because I know it intimately-ish. And I know that, you know, Pettis has gone down to train there in Albuquerque. A lot of that's because of Izzy Martinez, the wrestling coach. I know the guys go to American Top Team. That's because of Dana Vondolay, the jiu-jitsu coach. He knows Ricardo Laborio. So, you know, there's always going to be attention, but at the end of the day, people pay for a service. And Team Alpha Male has guys on the team so long as those guys on the team feel that they're valuable. And, you know, maybe they go up to Grudge or Team Elevation, whatever, and they may be the same thing now. And they train a little bit, and then they come back to Sacramento because they like the way that Uriah or Justin Buchholz or Fabio Prada, you know, put together things and kind of fine-tune everything. You know, you look at Cowboy Cerrone. He's got his own gym in his fucking, you know, garage or whatever, his barn. He trains with his buddies. He trains up in Denver sometimes. And then he comes back down to Albuquerque with Greg Jackson for some refinement. Greg Jackson's the guy there in his corner. So it's not a static, you know, a binary this or that. It's very fluid, and I think that the fighters and the coaches all benefit the more that they understand that that's just the nature of the beast these days.
In the opener of the main card on Fox, it's Alan Jobin versus Mike Van versus Mike Perry. Platinum Mike Perry, I should say. Perry is an interesting dude. He's the guy who I think his cornerman, I want to say they were calling, I think it was Kim, like slant eyes or something, like something racist. Like,
right.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Perry's done and said some questionable stuff over the years. But he's an interesting dude. He's kind of got an old school just brawl and put it out there style, but at the same time, he is rough around the edges for sure. So an interesting fight. Should have some action just because Perry's involved to open the card, which is what they typically try and do on these Fox shows. Put on a good action fight to start it. You would have to figure that Jobin would be the favorite, but just based on his experience and everything. But Perry hits hard, and he's going to go out there to steal the show, I would think.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Alan Jobin has an after-hours career as a male model, and if you're the kind of people that engage in racist rhetoric to get you pumped for a fight, probably don't like that kind of man, so some tension could arise there. If I set a slant eye or whatever, be like, look at that, he wears makeup sometimes for photographs. Yeah, go on, kick that makeup there, motherfucker. So, whatever.
Yeah. So then the rest of the card, the prelims and everything, really nothing major on the undercard of that show. Anything catch your eye?
No, I look at the show as top heavy and sure, like a good woman. And it's good. I just have in the back of my mind WCW New Blood or something like that. Like, they're just purposely pushing younger fighters into the spotlight, and that's a really good thing. And, you know, credit to the UFC is looking at the future, whether it's Dana or Sean Shelby or this is some remnants from before. That's part of the reason why the UFC has been able to sustain their success, is that they'll take a UFC on Big Fox show and they'll throw in a Uriah Faber fight, which is, you know, it's a name. Then they put Paige, they put Sage, they put Mickey Gall, they put Michelle Waters, and like, those are four people that, even if they only hit on one of them to become a star, that's a big deal. Like, MMA is a sport where you just need one out of 10 people fighting or whatever to become a star. They're putting people that are in their early 20s who are good looking, who are everybody involved in those two semi-main events. I would say they're both semi-main events. They're all marketable. And credit to the UFC for pushing them that way. That's exactly what you should do when you're on free TV in the middle of December and people need something to watch on a Saturday night because football's the next night and college is over. So credit to the UFC for doing that.
Yeah, I like the main card. I think all four fights are fun and have potential to be, you know, entertaining fights. On the undercard, maybe the biggest name's Cole Miller. And win or lose his fight, he could be your next barista at Starbucks.
That's it. We're done, everybody. We're ending on that fucking high note. Go out on the closer. We're not doing any better than that. That was fantastic.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Unless we have anything else.
I think that's it.
Yeah, I killed the crowd.
Yeah, we've already gone long enough.
Yeah, I'm surprised you're still doing this shit.
You mean tonight or just in general?
Tonight specifically, but in general, yeah.
Hey, well, once the kids are tucked in, I'm good. They're asleep. I'm fine. I'll be up for a while.
How do you do that shit? How do you fucking have children and do this shit?
I don't know. I don't know. I that's a good question.
Do you ever resent them?
No.
You've never looked at your kids and been like, you know, if I didn't have you, I
resents not, no. I get frustrated with them sometimes, but I never resent them, no.
How old are they?
My son's 3, my daughter's 8.
The only kid I know is 5.
You know one kid?
Pretty much, yeah. I got some cousins with kids. I don't see them often. It's just my friend Megan, her kid's 5, and, you know, he's nice to me, and apparently he's just a horrible fucking little bastard at home. But in public with other people, he's good. And I always tell her, I go, it doesn't matter how he acts at home. If the kid acts properly in public, you're doing a good job. And
that's probably what people told your mom.
Well, I was a really, really good kid. Like at home and in public. Until, I don't know, sometime in my 20s, I was an amazing child. Apparently, I never cried. Everybody thought I was the sweetest, nicest kid ever. My brother was a bit of a dick. I was a great kid. My mom couldn't believe.
Humble, too.
I was awesome as a child. Now, I'm a fucking useless loser. So, it doesn't.
Is that like regression, you think? Or what's going on there?
I don't really. I think it's progression. I think that I'm acknowledging the futility of life, and I'm refusing to play by the man's rules, and therefore I've entered a different plane of existence that most people can only hope to achieve, whereby I have lowered everyone's expectations so low that anything I do in life is successful.
That's pretty deep.
Oh, it's deep, all right. And that's who the fuck are these guys at halfcredit.com, and as usual, even though I cut him off before and tried to get him to badmouth his children, which he wouldn't do because he's a good dad, I'll let Matt say goodnight, and then I can hit the button so it's over.
Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Aggressively, we all defend the role we play. Regrettably, time's come to send you on your way. We've seen it all, bonfires of trust, flash floods of pain. It doesn't really matter, don't you worry, it'll all work out. No, it doesn't even matter, don't you worry, that ain't what it's all about. We hope you enjoy.